Hey everyone, welcome to the Completely Unnecessary Podcast for Tuesday, April 6th. We're in April?
Tuesday! Yes, we are.
2021.
April. We're like many days into April.
Alongside
six
Ian,
days.
Alongside Ian Ferguson. Six isn't many. I'm Pat Contry.
It's a lot to me.
It's several. On the show today, we're talking about WADA games. We'll talk about independent game stores, Ian's bread and butter, if I must say.
Bread and butter, yes.
Bread and butter. We'll be doing a Patreon poll topic, your comments, talking about E3 a little bit. That's what's happening. We had a weekend and a Monday.
We did have a weekend.
NCAA basketball. Major League Baseball's back. We're playing sports again in front of people here and there.
Yeah, so the end of the NCAA tournament didn't do a whole lot for me. I did watch...
There's a guy pumping up the tournament. And you're like,
I know.
Oh.
Yeah, well, it depends. I mean, by the time I get to the Final Four, I can find games to watch.
You've watched 40 games by then, so you're out of it. Like, all right.
Well, I've watched a lot of basketball in a month. This is how it goes every year. I need to care somewhat about the teams in the final...
So you didn't care about Gonzaga?
I did care about Gonzaga a little bit, but not enough to really, you know, go out of my way yesterday to watch the National.
And the undefeated team dropped the ball, and they lost again. That happened, what, 3-4 years ago?
Yep.
It's hard to do that. It's hard to go undefeated. Like, that's hard to do.
But it was really nice to have the tournament. It occupied my mind for probably 2 weeks. I watched everything up until the Final Four, I think. I watched pretty much something from every round into the Elite Eight. But I'm trying. I try every year. I try to pay attention to the Padres.
That's Ian in the corner. Padres are supposed to be good this year.
Padres have been good for the past couple of years.
Tatis hurt his wrist though yesterday. He took a swing and like
no.
That's not so.
That's not
we'll
good.
We'll see. Let me look that up.
Baseball can be difficult for me. Some years I can get into it. Some years I can't.
Shoulder injury being evaluated.
God damn.
Well, that's not probably major. Maybe a month or so. Because they signed him for, what, $1 billion at $1 billion, whatever it is.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The Mets spent $500 million literally in the offseason, the most by any team by far. The Mets have a new owner who's spending money because it's a real franchise in New York City. So they want to actually not be the fucking stepchild going forward to the Yankees. So I'm like, here you go. But, of course, the Mets' first game, one of the best pitchers of the past 30 years, maybe 40 years, DeGrom, scoreless, six innings. And the Mets bullpen comes in and gives up 5 runs in the 8th. And that's how you know we're back to normal. Jacob DeGrom's brilliant starts get squandered again. So, anyway. That's our baseball talk.
That's the baseball talk for this week.
I'm Pat and the Mad Dog. Can you do a Chris Russo Mad Dog expression?
I can't.
I'll be the Mad Dog. It's Ian and the Mad Pat. You can do a friend. Says, hey, everyone. Where's my Diet Coke? I mean, if you grew up in the East Coast, you know what Mike and the Mad, like, they were an institution. They were like the original two guys talking about sports radio with wacky person. They were it. They were it. If you never grew up with them, they're like, oh, what's so special about that? They were it. Like, that was the template going back to the late 80s. I think they started like 89.
Yeah, that. I think that's probably
so
right.
I listened to Mike and the Mad Dog on the radio almost every day of my childhood, like, life. Like, that's what you did, you know. And now Chris Russo, Mad Dog, does a serious thing, and then Francesa pretends to still know what's going on his own little... They brought him back. He retired, and they brought him back the next year because ratings tank without him. He's back on The Fan, WFAN. That was the original sports radio station, again, in New York, so that was the template. They brought him back, and he does that, and he does a podcast, but Mike Francesa, if you don't know him, there's a whole Twitter account called Back After This, the Funhouse, that lists all the top moments of Mike not knowing what he's talking about or saying, I never said that when he said...
Oh, really?
Yes.
That's great.
And the thing about Mike Francesa, he's the blowhard New Yorker that only knows about... He follows football and baseball and the Yankees, but he lives in New York, which is a 4-sport town.
Yeah.
Basketball is huge in New York City. Hockey is huge in New York City. He can't even pretend to follow those two sports, especially basketball, which has blown up a ton the past 6, 7, 8, 10 years.
Sure.
He doesn't even pretend to like know what's happening. So like he'll say stuff and like he doesn't know what he's talking about. So follow, I think it's called Funhouse. Just look up Back After This, AFTA, because that's what he says. Back After This. And he's known for falling asleep on camera when he was on the Yes Network, literally falling asleep. But I never fell asleep. No, he fell asleep. Because you can see him wake up with the mic up. He's like, where am I? What's going on? He's funny, Mike Francesa. If you're in New York, New Jersey, or Connecticut, you're like, yes, Pat. Or even Pennsylvania. But otherwise, you're like, who the hell are you talking about? There was a 30 for 30 on them that came out a couple years ago. But they were that important, Mike and the Mad Dog. So anyway, that's not what we're doing, though. We're doing a podcast about video games.
That's right. That is what we're doing.
And Mario is dead officially.
He's dead. They killed him.
Mario is dead. I don't know how that started. Like, I guess it blew up. And then Nintendo even said, hey, it's the last day we're celebrating. It was like a 6-month celebration of Super Mario Brothers for the 35th anniversary. So that meant like you couldn't play Super Mario 35 after, was it the end of March? That was what night? Was that Wednesday night? Well, no, it was on the weekend. What day was that? When was the end of Mario? I should know this as a podcaster. Was it Wednesday? The end of Mario or Thursday or Friday? When was the end of Mario? Mario dies.
It died on the 31st.
That was the 31st.
Yeah.
So I it was like 11 p.m. I was like almost starting to like fall asleep on the couch. I was convalescing. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, you know, it would be nice to play Super Mario 35, but I've played it before. I didn't play it in the past couple months. It's like, oh, it's a nice memory. Then something said, you should play. You should get this last moment of playing this game because it might not come back like this.
Right.
So I'm like, all right, let's fire it up. Get my pro controller. Thankfully, it was still charged from last time. Let's do it. I turn it on. Play the first game. This is how my Super Mario 35 runs usually go. Pretty good first run.
Sure.
Top five.
Yeah, okay.
I'm focused. That's but then Pat right? gets overconfident, and then he does a stupid error in the second game where he's like, oh, I got in fifth place. And then I come in like 15th or 20th place afterwards. Then I'm like, wow, Pat, you're stupid. Let's button it up. Then the third run is like my peak. And that's what happened. So I was like fifth place, whatever, 25th place, and then 5 minutes before midnight, I put it on Twitter. If you saw it, I got first place. Nice. It was a tough first place. It was like one of those, you're down to two guys for like 10 minutes, and it got to the point where it's going even faster, the time going down. So I'm like, oh, I got 400 coins built up. I got to just keep hitting the time, hopefully.
Yeah.
Yes. Smash that button. And that's what saved me, because I was like, wow, this is bad. I'm down to like 20 seconds. It's going fast. Keep hitting it. I couldn't use the coins fast enough at that point.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? But that's why you build your coins up. That's Pat's strategy. You build your coins early and often.
Yeah, you got to collect the shit out of them coins.
Yes, you got to get to like a good like 350, 400 coins to get when you're down to the last five. That's Pat's tip when it comes to that. Focus on the coins. Time you can always make up before the timer starts going down. Like you have time to go slow, stomp on enemies. I'm giving advice to a game that's dead, basically.
Yes.
But anyway, so I got in first place, and so it felt weird. I'm like, yeah, this is bad that this is going away. There's no way. There's no positive way to spin that this game's going away.
It's a really dumb thing that they did.
People would pay like $4 a month, I think, just to play this game. They'll pay like a subscription, I think, if they tack this on. So like a premium. I always said Nintendo could do a premium online service and give you more stuff or like whatever, $5, $10 more bucks a month, and people would pay it. You know, for something like
the limiting the physical copies of something, it sounds bad, but as I've argued before on this podcast, it's just a different way of saying what's always gone on. The games are not perpetually in production. They all have a period of time where they are provided, and that's that. It's not like they went and took all the copies off the shelf.
Yeah, it's not like Target. They can't tell Target to rip everything off the shelves. No, if they have their stock, they're going to put the stock
out. Like for instance, our friends up at Pink Gorilla Games, there was a picture that they've got a ton of copies. They bought a ton of physical copies of it that will provide people with those copies for quite some time. You know, in that area, they can't make those go away. It's like I said, it's really business as usual, I think, when it comes to that. But putting up a digital game and then removing it, that I have a much larger problem
with. That spits in the face of game preservation.
Yeah, that I have a big problem
with. Because even if someone figures out how to bring that back, right, and puts up their own servers, it's not Nintendo running the game anymore, right? You'll never be able to replicate that experience. And that's really what game preservation is to me, truly at the core. is replicating the original experience of playing that game. That, to me, it's like, that's the most, you know, the basic level. Yeah, you can play the game, but how are you playing it when it first came out? How are you experiencing it? And trying to get back to that is, for digital, it's going to be tough.
Yeah, the ease of, I mean, even, yeah, even if it's somehow brought back, like you said, private server, something like that, it's not... Yeah, the ease of accessibility is going to change how many people are playing it and how easy it is to just jump in and have fun or something like that.
So you can still buy new, maybe not through Amazon. Maybe they said Amazon pull them off, or they were, but you can get them on Amazon, $55. You can get 3D All Stars. So don't go to scalpers.
I have to be honest with you.
Best Buy has them listed on eBay for $60. So Best Buy's account is listing them, so they have a ton of them.
Yeah.
So, like,
they're not going anywhere. Get a copy if you want it, but I mean, you shouldn't have to buy anything from a scalper.
Best Buy has sold 900, according to this. More than 10 available. Yes, I'm sure it's more than 10 available. I'm sure it's more than 1,000 available.
Sure,
yes.
It's far more than 10 available.
They just do that, you know. Yeah. That's for my book. It's like more than 10 available. You put the. Yeah. So that doesn't concern me, honestly. That. Like, that's. There's millions of these physical copies. Like, don't worry about that.
They're out there.
It's out there. It's Mario 35. That's a crime. That's really the criminality of this.
Yes.
You know. And speaking of that, Microsoft came out maybe because of this and talked about game preservation, kind of surprisingly.
Interestingly, yes. It's one of those things where...
Weird timing.
I think it also has to do with Sony. That one guy at Sony is, like, real big on... Remember we talked about him?
He's like, oh, I don't know why you want to play the original Gran Turismos. And everything. It's like, what are you, nuts?
And Sony doesn't focus on backwards compatibility, whereas Microsoft does. So this is just one of those areas where Microsoft does manage to generally make themselves seem more like the good guy than...
Swapped from the PS3 thing when, you know, Sony was, like, anti-DRM and Xbox was trying to push it. And now...
And that was Xbox One when Microsoft was trying to be always online. Yeah,
no. But now it's Switch, where Microsoft is more like consumer friendly. It seems they're like, or trying to.
They're trying. I mean, they're. I don't know. They're trying. I don't think there's much.
My hair sticking up.
I don't think there's much that's consumer friendly about buying up large companies. But
no, I mean, well,
but they're trying
for the
to,
consumer.
They're trying to have a positive. Consumer
PR,
facing
PR
front.
Face.
Yes,
well,
yes. They're
matters.
Trying to have a good PR face.
Most people don't know that Microsoft's buying up all these
companies.
And
it's not hard to say this. It's not hard to, you know, say that you care about game preservation. It's an easy thing to do for a cheap pop and an easy win. And it's odd to me that
Foley pop?
It's odd to me that other companies don't care more about the preservation.
Right here in Allentown, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Thumbs up. So they said it's more important than ever to preserve classic games. Whether your first time playing Morrowind is from 2002 on your Xbox or 2021 on your phone, we're excited to share these experiences with you. It was announced that backward-compatible games have been added to Xbox Cloud Gaming. The console's social media team took to Twitter to clarify their views on the preservation of classic games. As time goes on, it becomes more important than ever that we ensure gaming icons and classics. They announced this on the 31st. I don't think it's coincidence.
No,
I preserve for new and old players alike.
It's just it's a really big 1-2 punch because it was right after Sony talked about pulling down the PS3, the Vita, and the PSP store.
I'm sure. I mean, Microsoft has become like kind of like weird, not pals with Nintendo the past few years, but like second cousins that they hang out with at a party.
They don't have an abrasive relationship.
Yeah. But they obviously communicate, and they're not going at each other.
Right.
Microsoft has, like, embraced Nintendo at being that, like, you know, oh, there are pals. They're like, you know, Sony hasn't, but Microsoft has. So, yeah, they said we're excited to show this. So, like you said, it's easy to do it, but now are they going to follow through with it going forward? And it seems like, you know, they try to do the backwards compatibility stuff. We'll see. While Sony's abandoning it. So, I mean, it's better than not having it.
Sure.
You know, that's all I got to say about it, but too bad more of this isn't happening. They're almost doing it more than Nintendo. Nintendo's like, yeah, we'll resell you the same game. That's our preservation. We'll resell you these games 15, 20 years later. We'll give you the privilege of buying these games again. That's how we're preserving them for you. I mean, that's basically what they're doing.
It's a fucking bummer. And we can say fuck now.
Yes, we can, Ian.
We can say fuck.
Well, we could always say fuck, but when Ian said, like, fuck Billy Mitchell 5 seconds in, I'd get demonetized and have to, like, go back and plug away and pull the factory and go and re-edit and like bleep out Ian and re-render, and Ian's at home sipping his Mai Tais, and I'm working. Well, we don't have to worry about that to quite the same extent anymore, because we can curse.
We can curse. And we videos. Can curse freer and easier. As I've gotten older,
do you sip Mai Tais while I'm editing, Ian?
Curse less. No, I don't.
You don't curse less. You are less
I think
creative, I think, in terms of
probably
people pissing in their own mouths. No, you still say that.
Oh, I will definitely say that some people.
You got angry. What was it last week? Was it 1 week or 2 weeks ago? You got super ornery for the
podcast. I was angry about like three things last week.
Yeah, it was old school Ian to an extent. It was
crabby.
Yeah, it was crabby Ian.
Less crabby this week.
So you can swear without risking demonetization, according to this GameSpot article. I had no idea that, you know, I didn't get an email about this. Previously, YouTube allowed for light profanity like hell or damn. It's like PG cursing in monetized videos. Now the YouTube will allow moderate profanity like shit and bitch in the first 30 seconds of a video. There you go, Ian. You can
I can shit
moderate. You can shit and bitch people out. Probably can't use the F word. You can use infrequent strong profanity. So they have machine learning, if you didn't know that.
Yes.
Out there. So when Ian goes off on Zack Snyder or Michael Bay, he can probably say the F word like twice.
Right.
By the third time, okay, we might limit the monetization on this.
Yeah. You
know, maybe do that. But anyway, YouTube will let content creators monetize videos about, this is more important to me, they'll monetize videos about recreational drugs and drug-related content, documentary or news content that may include violent interactions with law enforcement, and controversial issues where non-graphic, objective discussions of objective discussions? I don't know what that means. I guess like a news thing. Of controversial issues are in the video. So before, there were people that were covering some news stories or some social issues that, well, if there was some tinge of something in there that was social upheaval or maybe like a protest or a riot, they were automatically demonetized. That's it. Now they're allowing more freedom for that, which is good to talk about these sort of things. Creators will also be able to monetize more videos that feature adult themes delivered through the context of humor. I don't know how you're going to get around that with machine learning, such as romance and dating jokes. I couldn't do a dating joke before. Really? The site also provided more specific examples for content that still cannot be monetized, including adult content. Well, can't show your peen. Harmful or dangerous acts.
No peen.
And firearms-related content. So that's interesting, because there's gigantic YouTube channels, usually like they're in Russia, with guys with, you know, heavy machine guns firing shit off, and they get tons of views. Hey, I got this automatic shotgun, Ian. Gas-powered automatic shotgun. I don't know how they get it. It's Russia. In Russia, you can own a Tiger. So, I mean, you can do whatever. But, like...
Yeah, true.
So, I guess that's going away.
Can you own a Tiger in Russia?
Dude, there's freaking Instagram accounts of people sleeping with freaking mountain lions in their beds.
Wild stuff.
The exotic pet trade thing, that's why when people would show me, oh, look, this is cool. I said, no, we don't want this shit happening. We don't want to encourage people trying to get big cats.
No.
No, that's bad. That's bad for the cats, and it's bad for people. It's bad for everyone. And they end up having miserable lives sometimes. Sorry. Go on. So these are all positive changes.
No, they're good.
It's all good.
It's all good.
Unless you want an OnlyFans thing, you can't show nudity. Go on OnlyFans and do that. Or get your private Snapchat or what have you. Just don't do it as a YouTuber preying on your fans. That's still bad. To do that. Really bad. E3 news, Ian. You excited?
No.
No.
No, I'm not. I don't get excited about...
When's the last time you got excited for E3? Literally. Like 5 years ago? 6 years ago?
The 2000s? Maybe?
You weren't excited like early 2000s?
Early
2000s. 2010s?
I can't tell you exactly when it was, but whenever all that information became easily available online minutes or hours after it was announced at E3.
Well, that'd be like 2013.
Probably 12. Even earlier than that.
Well, I'm talking about social media age where literally
sure.
Tweet out. You didn't go to a website and wait for IGN to like type up an article.
But yeah, I mean, a lot of these companies don't use E3 as their big announcement dumping ground anymore. Nintendo does the Direct. Sony has their own state of play.
Nintendo abandoned them like 5 years ago.
Microsoft announces stuff all year long. I mean, there are still big announcements at E3, but it hasn't mattered in a long, long time. And moving it online and charging for it this year, I mean, I understand.
Oh, they're charging for it? I thought it was free.
I thought they were charging.
Oh.
Let me take a look and see.
When I say Nintendo and Bandit, yeah, they would go every year, but they don't, it's not their announcement place anymore like it used to be. When they would do their own, you know, their own presentations, they just do their
directs. The event will be entirely free. I heard early reports. After previous reports that part of E3 2021 could put behind paywalls, the ESA told IGN that E3's digital show is a free event for all attendees. Okay.
Because if I'm Nintendo or Microsoft, I'd be like, well, no. What, do it free or we'll just release our own videos. Like, there's no there's no advantage of going through E3's firewall to get the information out.
I'm certain at one point E3 probably wanted to try to charge money and people were like, that's not going to happen.
And Nintendo's like,
no one is going to pay for that.
Nintendo's like, we're doing you a favor. You're not doing us a favor anymore, E3. We don't need you anymore. Microsoft does not need, you know, the ESA.
Well, there goes all my vitriol for this topic, but I mean, it's still silly.
I see people. I don't know some of these people and journalists that work for these like IGN are like, I'm honestly excited this year for this. I'm like, are you really? I know you get a lot of content for your site, and you work for them. Are you really excited about having a 3-day digital event? Excuse me, 4 days, 12, 13, 14, a 4-day digital event.
I think some people are probably excited that they don't have to leave.
I think we're in a different spot even from 3-4 years ago, where I'd rather have information come out where I can easily track it. I don't have to want to be glued. Obviously, yes, if you're huge into this and you want to get tons of information over 4 days, but most people, the average Joe, don't have time for it, to be locked down to, well, I'm going to watch 8-9 different hour presentations. No. I'm not binge watching presentations. Give me the recap,
right?
And I'm good. I think we're in a different spot, you know. But people like to go on Twitch, and people will watch their Twitch streamer or YouTube streamer watch the presentation.
Sure.
People ask me, "Hey Pat, are you going to stream Nintendo Direct?" And I'm like, "I guess I could, but like."
My problem with the Nintendo Directs is everyone streams Nintendo Directs. Like, literally, every time that a Nintendo Direct comes out, it's like every single person I follow who does any YouTube, it's like, come join me while we stream the Direct. And that's fine, but I wonder how many people are does anyone actually tune in for anyone's streams if everyone's streaming?
Well, that's a thing, right? Yeah. It's like, what's become a YouTube? There's so many. Anyone can stream now.
Right.
Where it's like, people are excited to becoming Twitch affiliates because, you know, the bar is not high to get there. But it's like, once you have millions of people doing it, no one's going to stand out. You know what I mean? It's hard to stand out when everyone's doing it. That's a thing. And I respect the hustle, but what I'm saying is that, you know, it's tough when everyone's doing the same thing when it comes to that. But no, people like to get together and hang out. I get that.
Yeah, no, I've contemplated streaming the Directs too, just because I like the Direct and it would be fun. But
when are you going to stream, man? People want to see you.
I fucking hate it. It's so stress-inducing. Blah.
I stream every Wednesday, twitch.tv/countrycode, 80s commercials coming your way almost a year straight.
Yeah.
Cheap plug. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, so, all right. It's going to be a thing. I don't know if Nintendo's going to use that to make any huge announcements, though, being that they just had a big Direct, and that'll be still like 4 months away from the fall or 5 months.
Well, if
maybe they'll do the Super Switch announcement.
I was going to say, if all signs are indicative of the Super Switch, they would probably announce that at E3. Why not?
We'll see. Or maybe they'll announce the Legend of Zelda 35th event, maybe for a fall. Will they do 2 35ths in I mean, it's Zelda. It's their second biggest franchise. I mean, I can see them doing that.
I feel like they've gotta.
They gotta. I'm not saying you gotta do it for Metroid this year, but like, yeah, Zelda and Mario, come on.
Even every 5 years is a lot to celebrate.
Well, they did did they do a 30th for Mario or just a 25th?
They did a 30th.
25th had that Wii release, right?
I think they did a 30th.
I don't remember the 30th. But Nintendo respects the fives and zeros. That's why we like Nintendo.
Yes.
They didn't do the freaking 34th Mario anniversary.
Thank goodness.
They didn't do that.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
We should have talked about this about game preservation, about this Castlevania Dreamcast prototype being found.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring this up. Castlevania Resurrection.
Sounds like a bad movie.
Which was to star Sonia Belmont, who was introduced in Castlevania Legends on the Game Boy, and was going to introduce Victor Belmont. Was shown in various magazines around the time that the Dreamcast was launched. It was going to be, I believe, the first game done by Konami America. Ended up never coming out. Rumors were, even early in development, that it wasn't shaping up to be a particularly great game. It was linear 3D. It looked like it was going to kind of almost follow in the footsteps of like the Castlevania 64 game.
I was going to say, those aren't super open world. Those are pretty linear.
Yeah, right? I think it would have been something closer to that than, you know, the Lords of Shadow games that came out, you know, later. Rumors were that there were people within Konami who didn't like that the American development studio was making it, and they were trying to sabotage it internally.
Sabotage!
So, yeah, it was canceled, but someone did find a build with some of the parts playable. I did not watch a whole lot of it, and there's not a whole lot of info other than that, but that's one that I think a lot of people have been hoping to find to get out there. I also think they were probably hoping it was in closer to complete condition, and from what I understand, this is still pretty rough around the
edges. It's pre-alpha.
Yeah.
Like, she's walking around in lava, for example. It's a three-minute YouTube video. The only thing they've ever uploaded, and it was a YouTube channel just for this called CVR Exists is the name of the YouTube channel. So that's funny. And then it's not direct gameplay. You see the controller in the hand. This individual is playing it on the TV. So people are asking, are you going to dump it? Are you going to do it? Someone said, this person named Chuck says, while you're in no obligation to rip it, it would be amazing if you do it for preservation purposes. If you have no intention of sharing it, at least make a personal backup, since CDs don't last forever. Yeah, rip it and put it on a hard drive and put it on the cloud, your personal cloud. Like, put it somewhere. Because a CD may not last forever.
No.
They can last decades, but, like, they can go.
Yeah, even if you're not going to dump it for the public, which you should, definitely, you know, put it, do something to preserve it, you know, within your own capabilities. Dump it to a computer, rip it, make multiple CDs.
Yeah, a lot of people are asking about it on here. I would implore you to dump an ISO of the game for preservation, if nothing else. This is a huge thing for the community. I would think that this individual would do that, but who knows? See, a lot of times the reason they don't do it publicly because they think they can cash in. I'm not saying this person's going to do it, but they didn't cash in selling this. This is why, again, I do not like the publicizing of something like Force of Illusion saying, hey, we paid money to have this dump, because you're negotiating with terrorists at that point. That's what you're kind of doing.
Sure.
Game preservation terrorists. You're negotiating with them. You should not make that public. And it's probably happening less and less where these are being held hostage, but it's still happening, obviously.
Yeah.
There's still stuff that people have privately that has not been preserved that we know about.
Right.
It's just a fact. When it comes down to it, you want to talk about Metroid Prime 2D before Nintendo says you're not doing this anymore?
All I want to say about this is it looks nice and it's not long for this world. I mean, we've been doing this long enough that there was another 2D Metroid remake that we were watching
5 years ago.
Yeah.
Well, Nintendo was working on their own, so that was gone immediately. This, though, they've been working on. It's a graphic styling like that. They've been working on this, they said, for 15 years, these people.
15
years!
This is kind of cooler to me in a way, because it's not... the Metroid 2 remake was cool looking. But this is actually taking Metroid Prime, and I don't know if you even want to say... I mean, it looks fantastic. Demaked back into a 2D game. So they're taking, the first-person game and, you know, kind of reimagining it as a 2D side-scrolling shooter.
So
it was.
I mean, Nintendo's still going to... If this ever comes to light, Nintendo's still come down in this, but at least it's not a direct...
No, I mean, obviously they're going to come down on it. I just think this looks... This is a very cool idea. And the graphics are gorgeous.
But this is what I mean when it comes to this. I'm not putting these people down. I mean, if you work on this for over a decade, you're working on this. And people are even in the comments saying, why are you announcing this before it's done? Nintendo's going to cease and desist you. I get that. My whole point is, if you did just a spiritual successor to the game, change Samus's design.
Sure.
Call it something else. Change the name of the items. Change the enemies. And you could release it as your own game.
No,
and you would still get fanfare.
You and I always talk about this, though. We wonder why these people with this great amount of talent put all this time into something that is almost never going to be able to see the light of day officially.
Maybe some people don't care about it, but I'm just saying, like, all that time and effort, and you can't even put it out for free, though. That's what you can't even put it out for. It's not about making money. You can't even put it out for free if you want to.
Right.
At that point. Like, it's just... So, this is a nice nice quote or nice comment. Congratulations on your inevitable cancellation. Now you made it public before it was properly complete, but this looks genuinely incredible and impressive.
Yeah, I saw something like that too. That was like, congratulations on your upcoming cease and desist, because that's exactly what's coming.
Nintendo, hippity hoppity, you're dead. This looks amazing. Shame Nintendo is such a stubborn company that sees fan passion projects as personal attacks. Well, it's not a personal attack. Definitely going to give the demo a shot myself. I would love to see this project fully realized. Unless they realize we're so far away from having this completed that we're just going to put it out there. We know we're never going to complete it.
Right. They don't see it as a personal attack.
I don't think Nintendo's like, oh, damn it, they did a fan project.
No, it's protecting IP.
Protecting IP. And the last time this happened, they actually were doing their own game, so it was directly, yeah. But it's been out for 3 days, and it's still online here, so.
Yeah.
Is the download link still there? Okay. It's still there. So Nintendo's lawyers don't know about it yet.
Get it while it's hot. We probably
but they will.
This worse.
Get it while it's hot?
Yeah.
Get that flapjack. You know what you can get while it's hot?
Pins, shirts, books.
Certain books are hot at ultimatenintendo.com.
All sorts of things.
Not for resale Blu-ray. You can go on there. You can find the stuff you like for... let's see. Is there any gift-giving holiday in the spring? No. Easter's gone. I used to get like one little gift for Easter. Sometimes my spoiled cousin would get Super Mario 3, and I'd be jealous.
It's absurd.
Or Super Mario 2, and I'm like, oh, you got a Nintendo game for Easter? I get like Cadbury cream eggs and maybe a little stuffed troll. Or stuffed troll, or like the troll dolls that were big.
We would always get something super, super tiny. Like, I mean real tiny. Like,
I got an Easter basket.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like $50 gifts in there.
No, exactly.
Maybe there was like a G.I. Joe. A $3 G.I. Joe, if I was lucky, you know?
My mom in particular loved to do a scavenger hunt every year. We had fun with
it. No, we never did
that. It was just an excuse to do a scavenger hunt. She'd write clues and hide eggs, and then at the end we'd get our basket with chocolate in there.
Can I have your mom? Can she adopt me?
No, she's my mom. You can't have my mom.
Damn it.
Sorry,
Mom. What else is going on?
Delays.
Delay of something that Ian ordered.
Yes.
That Pat missed out on because Ian doesn't love me.
So Analog Pocket has been officially delayed. I think we were all expecting that. There was a lot of quietness surrounding it as we approached the month it was supposed to come out. I thought it was April. I guess it was supposed to be out in May.
Quietness. I want to look that up and see if
quietness.
That's a word.
Probably not.
Is that different than silence?
Silence.
Quietness is a word.
There
absence of noise or bustle.
See?
I don't think I've ever used that word before in my life, quietness.
Well, now you can. now that you know about
people
it,
people also
can.
Ask, is quietness a real word? So people do ask this. Okay,
oh, I'm sure. So is it a bummer? Yes, it's absolutely a bummer. My problem is that the pre-order was taken so far in advance that it does feel like we're giving them an interest-free loan at this point. That said... I understand that there are part shortages. I understand things happen. I understand and have seen Analog ship and make plenty of products. So it's not
at risk.
It's not at risk.
It's not a first timer doing this.
Right. This isn't a Polymega situation. This isn't an Amico situation. This is a company that has done this stuff in the past. So I still have faith that I'm going to get it.
This company's been around for like 10 years.
Still have faith that I'm going to get the product. But yeah, I was starting to look forward to getting this in my hands in May.
And we had not heard anything about pre-order on the Duo, which could have been a hint as well.
Probably smart part to not do anything with the Duo until they are certain that the part shortages are not going to affect it. So I have a feeling it's going to be a while before we see pre-orders for the Duo. I think we probably won't see pre-orders for the Duo until much later this year, maybe October or November.
And before you ask, no, it has nothing to do with the stuck freighters in the Suez Canal that literally affected the world economy.
Yeah.
And trade. Isn't that nuts that a stuck ship can do that?
Yep.
It was stuck for like 5-6 days, and like, so ships had to go around the fucking south of Africa to get to Europe. Like we're back in the oldie times.
Yeah, they had to go around
800 years ago or 500 years ago. Like you're Columbus. trying to get spices, find spices from the east. Like, that's what happened.
Yes.
The freighter was longer than the width, and somehow it got turned. Oh, they're in trouble, probably. Anyway, so that's not why this is happening. Pat put on his Herm Burford out-of-control news hat, and he's talked to his source, saying, why is this chip shortage happening the past year? What is going on? And from my reliable source told me this. It goes back to cars, automobile sales.
Right.
So what happened is nowadays there's computers. Your car is a computer basically at this point.
Right.
It's not the old days with your catalytic converters and things like that. There's computer chips and boards and such in your car. So when the pandemic happened, all the electronic components people, you know, assumed like, well, you know, we don't have to produce all this stuff. And even the car companies were like, well, we don't have to order as many because people won't be buying cars during a pandemic. That didn't happen. People bought cars last year. So it was a lot more than they thought. So that sent everything to a tailspin. So the car manufacturers then get first priority on this stuff. So then everyone else then who needs components is like, holy shit, I better order these whatever parts I can right now to make sure that I have them, even if I'm not making stuff for them yet. So it became a toilet paper scenario.
Gotcha.
For parts. So there are companies hoarding this stuff, these components, that aren't even really using them. Just having them just in case. And that's created this whole cascading effect across the industry. And my source said, well, they're now, it might not be cleared up now for several months to catch up on getting the supplies made across the industry, because now you have companies not using this shit. They ordered it. They went overboard and ordering it. The same thing what people do with the toilet paper.
Sure.
I'm going to go out to Costco and I'm going to get 800 rolls of toilet paper that will take me 17 years to shit and use these. This is the electronic component version of that that's happened. If you're doing anything modern, you know, you're kind of delayed here. So you sad, Ian?
Yeah, I'm bummed. But I'll live.
Maybe, though, this will give them time to do another pre-order. Maybe.
Yeah.
Before that comes out. We'll see.
At the very least, I think they'll have a better idea of what they can have
produced
within the next 2 years.
Sure. You want to talk about Counter-Strike match fixing?
Yeah, so match fixing has gotten so bad in Counter-Strike that apparently they're involving the FBI in the United States. This
FBI,
was reported by Kotaku Australia. So basically they're talking about how match fixing is a problem in Counter-Strike. It's real bad in Australia, and apparently it even says here the police said the first part will be dealt with. This will be dealt with quickly because they're dealing with idiots.
Okay.
Yeah, they're dealing with idiots. Yeah, people who are just betting on their own matches and stuff like that.
Okay.
Yeah, in Australia. But the article goes on to talk about how the FBI is starting to get involved with this in the U.S. That's what they said is classic match fixing, people being bribed by outside betting syndicates in order to fix matches. It's not being done by the players to each other to make them money. They're being contacted by outside betting syndicates.
It's how they used to do with college kids.
Yes, exactly. Or
the mob used to come to college kids and be like, okay, well, why don't you just, you don't have to throw the game, just shave some points off. I don't know if there's any point shaving here, but you know.
Yeah,
but then they tell you to lose a game, the mob, or else. Oh yeah, okay. Well, we'll just hurt you. We'll just break your legs so you can't play basketball anymore, or worse.
Yeah. So
I'm not saying that's what's happening here. We're going to break your fingers so you can't hit a mouse button.
But they're talking about how it's difficult in the U.S. and they're just starting to do it because most gambling and betting in the U.S. has been illegal and under the radar, so they're not paying attention to it. So things like match fixing, there's no legal reason for them to keep eyes on it, basically. And it highlights a problem that I think and I can make this argument for a lot of things, drugs, prostitution, but gambling, you make it legal and you regulate it and it cuts down on the crime, or at least allows the crime to be more visible.
Yeah, the crime can be taken out a lot more readily. So online sports betting in the U.S., there's only like, I think, a handful of states where it's legal. Oh, Colorado, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Michigan, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Virginia, West Virginia. So Pat, Matt, that's like 20% of the U.S. only. So I don't know if you can bet on, I don't know if the online sports books in the U.S. have esports on it, But I'd be nuts if I got into it knowing this stuff is happening.
Yeah.
Be nuts. And that's the problem. The integrity of the sport is now non-existent, or game, e-sport, when you hear about this stuff. Like, this does not happen with professional sports. And it goes back to what I said, is like, well, these aren't athletes that spend their whole lives to play a sport and make millions of dollars that would never throw a game.
Right.
Because you throw everything away and they're well off. These are a lot of times younger people or kids that, all right, I'll take your money.
Yeah.
I'll take your 10 grand or 20 grand to throw this match. Like, who cares? Like, right. Why not? What am I going to lose? Oh, no, I can't play this online game anymore? Okay. No one's going to know about it. I'm not going to be humiliated like Pete Rose, or, you know what I mean? Like, who cares? So this is bad. This is really bad. This one, it makes you obviously not want to bet, but not want to watch this stuff when you know this happens. Because why? Right. There's no integrity anymore. Yeah, if you know it could happen.
It's happening too much for you to feel like you're watching something natural.
Yeah.
Not watching too... the whole time you're watching, you'll be asking, is this the... Am I watching, you know, the skill of two players, or am I watching something with, machinations in the background?
Sure.
So, yeah.
And there is this organization, the ESIC, I guess, to sort of make sure this isn't happening. But, let's see. They commented, the commissioner, the betting scandal in Australia, where whilst it was a large group of players, and there definitely is match fixing there, we're working with law enforcement there. It takes a lot longer there once you start working with the police. Fortunately, in Australia, these are criminal offenses. Wow. So getting it all coordinated with the police takes a lot longer. We've got great, solid cases there. And if it was just us acting alone, we'd announce these prosecutions now. But it isn't all 42 guys that were betting. It is a much smaller group within that. That we're not just betting, but manipulating outcomes. Cool. They might go to Australian prison.
Yeah.
Wow. I guess that's the way you do it. They're not just going to kick you out. You're going to do some jail time.
Right. This is actual punishment.
You're going to do some Aussie jail time here. I guess we'll catch up eventually once this happens. But that's the one thing that, even with the pandemic, I did not see there would be a huge uptick in interest in at least on the TV, on esports. There wasn't last year. People wanted real sports, and they try to throw in things here and there, and it was like, rather watch cornhole than watch someone play some of these games on TV, because it doesn't translate. But this doesn't help. Then wait for them to throw the cornhole. Can I bet on cornhole? That'd be great. Can I just do online gambling in California? What the hell are we waiting for? It's been decriminalized federally. Like, what the fuck are we waiting for? Regulate it and do it. It's ridiculous. I got to drive to Nevada to put in a bet. It's insane. Sorry. Speaking of gambling, a new study in the UK has found a robustly verified link between problematic gambling and loot boxes in video games. I am so shocked that loot box surprise mechanics is tantamount to gambling. That it could trigger the same, serotonin or whatever in your head. Oh, I feel good betting on shit and getting a nice, like, is anyone shocked?
No.
By this. So this was a report from the BBC conducted by researchers at the University of Plymouth and University of Wolverhampton. That's an awesome name in the UK. And commissioned by the charity Gambling Aware. It took existing data and examined elements such as gender, the age of spenders, and how much revenue is provided by a small number of spenders. So it sounds like a meta-analysis. Based on the research, they found that up to 40% of children who play games have open loot boxes. Holy shit, that's a high percentage.
That's a lot.
Though it does not mention if this number includes earned loot boxes or only paid ones. Okay. Still, the effect's the same. It also said it's priming you to be a gambler. It also said about 5% of players generate half the revenue from these loot boxes. That makes sense. There's always whales, even when it comes to mobile games. It's always like, it's median versus average.
Yes.
And dumb idiots running game companies don't know the difference between that, unfortunately. The difference between a median and a mean when it comes to this. Let's see. Small number of players are spending an exorbitant amount of money, and that younger, less educated men are the most likely to use them. Wow. Interesting. Spending can hit $100 per month, and with younger and less educated people typically having less disposable income, that is a sizable amount. In response, game publishers have typically pointed out that, like in something like poker, you're guaranteed to get some prize from a loot box. However, the pushback from players has still let them become a little less common in AAA releases. Yes, but poker never says, hey, we're not gambling. Poker's gambling.
Right. It's clearly gambling.
Even with skill involved, it's gambling. So they say out front, they're not trying to trick you. They're not going after poker. It is not advertised towards children. I never said, hey, little kids, play our puffy poker game with animals on the cards. I've never seen that in my life because it's regulated and you can't do that shit. So that's a bad argument to bring up poker right there. And I love poker. So not shocked, right?
No.
Surprised, but not shocked?
Not shocked.
And finally, we'll talk about police busting a game cheat operation in China.
Largest game cheat operation in the world. They busted several luxury sports cars were among assets seized in the raid. Yeah, it's pretty crazy. The only thing I really want to point out here is just how expensive some of this cheat shit is. I didn't realize. They sold their cheats were like $10 a day up to $200 a month to subscribe to these cheats.
And these included Overwatch and Call of Duty Mobile. Roughly $76 million in revenue was made by the organization. Was charged a subscription fee, according to this BBC article. It was a combination of Chinese police and gaming giant Tencent going after this group.
Oh, and I also wanted to comment on it. It was called Operation Chicken Drumstick.
That's a great name
of the cheat operation.
That is a great name.
They sold to hundreds of countries and regions. Chicken Drumstick.
If you're in this criminal organization, well, now they're criminal. I think it's weird. They found and destroyed 17 cheats and arrested 10 people in connection with the ring. Why are you buying these cars? You want to keep a low profile. Have you ever seen American Gangster when Denzel says when he gets that fur coat and he wears it and that's how they end up identifying him and he throws it in the fire? You keep a low profile. Great movie, American Gangster, by the way, if you never saw it.
I did.
Russell Crowe and the RZA's in it. Great part by the RZA.
Saw that a while back.
Yeah, it's a really good movie. Saw it in theaters. But you want to keep a low profile. You don't want to fucking go out with cars that cost $250,000.
No.
You want to make a nice... Plus, you want to invest, put in a nice IRA... Grow it slowly over time, not waste it on the cars. I'm just telling you. If I ever got rich, that's like the last thing I would do is buy 10 fucking sports cars. I don't want to do that. I just don't want.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No.
Maybe I'll buy a water park.
Yeah.
Let people come in free
that would
once
be
a
fun.
Week. Tuesdays are half price. There you go.
Tuesdays are half price.
Tuesday and Thursday, half price. Like Waterworks in Seaside Heights. Is that it for the intro?
Yeah, that's.
But why are you okay? You got the money to you're ruining people's day. Like you're spending $10 a day to access cheats. That just seems nuts, doesn't it? Like I'm trying to wrap my. I might have met an individual in my life that would do something like this. I just don't understand that. That's like a psychopathy at that point. That you want to cheat and not just cheat. You're willing to spend thousands of years.
Yeah, gets me. Yes, that's absurd.
That's ridiculous. All right, that's it for this intro. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Is there something interfering with your happiness or is preventing you from achieving your goals? During the lockdown, I know sometimes I felt a little down with everything going on. It's hard to get motivated to get things done. Well, BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can start communicating in under 48 hours. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online. There is a broad range of expertise available, which may not be locally available in many areas. The service is available for clients worldwide. You can log into your account anytime and send a message to your counselor. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses, plus you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions, so you won't ever have to sit around in an uncomfortable waiting room as with traditional therapy. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed. It's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available. BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. Visit their website and read the testimonials that are posted daily. Visit BetterHelp.com/CU podcast. That's Better H-E-L-P. And join the over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. You'll save 10% off your first month. Again, for that special offer to save 10% off your first month, visit betterhelp.com/CU podcast. All right, Ian, big news when it's come
in big
to the world of video game collecting and especially sealed game collecting. This is WADA graded sealed game collecting. That's been a market that's been pumped and primed over the last 2 years via articles and Pawn Star appearances and some coordinated effort between individuals between that own these games, that help run the grading company and Heritage Auctions, to pump up the prices of these. And this is the result. We are a little over 2 years into this. A Super Mario Brothers sealed NES, boxed NES game, went, including the commission, $660,000.
Jesus.
Officially making it the most expensive video game collectible ever sold to this point. The grade is high, 9.6. So it's a very high grade, obviously. That's like pulled factory fresh, basically.
Yeah.
I'm not saying there's a carton of these, because we'll get into who actually owned this later. So that part of the reason why I went for this much. However, unlike the prior one that was on Pawn Stars, that was, you know, a second print run from like early 86, this is not an early print run. This is like a mid-production print run. They are saying from roughly late 86, they are claiming. And I'll get into that claim in a bit. This is what they've done in order to drum up interest, is point out these are all these little differences we find in the boxes of these runs to make more of a market, versus just saying, okay, this is the hang tab versus non-hang tab, this is a sticker seal. Because I'm talking about for decades, that's all most collectors either identified or cared about.
Yeah.
We're like, okay, is it a hang tab or non-hang tab? Because that's a division around 87.
Right.
When Nintendo got rid of the hang tab. Okay, the sticker seal stuff. Almost all NES collectors knew about that. Nintendo did the sticker seal at first for the first, you know, year or so.
Correct.
That was all something that I would track other people. But now, for some of these more classic titles like Super Mario Bros. And Legend of Zelda and Mike Tyson's Punch-Out, it's like, okay, that's not enough. We have to now find these higher divisions.
Right, yes.
And we talked about before, they've even tried with like Rad Racer and Mega Man. And for most of those titles, it's not going to stick. But for some titles, It will.
Something like a Mario or a Zelda, that's actually going to mean something when it comes to collectors.
It won't for a Russian attack, you know?
Sure.
But it will for some of these classic games. So I'm not shocked to see something like this happen. I am still shocked to see this price, though. I'm very shocked. And before I get into it, I'm not accusing anyone of collusion when it comes to this stuff. But when you see something like this happen, with no precedent for something to hit this high standard like this, besides one prior sale of a game that came out, of a version that came out a year before this, I do, or close to a year, I do have questions. Because there has not been a gradual rise logically to get to this point. It's not like, well, the last one, Ian, went for 300 or 400, and before that it went for 200. You know, there has not been a gradual rise. This floored people. And floored me when I saw it.
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised. There are some people who are not. Some people, you know, aren't quite as surprised. But yeah, it's wild to see, and I do think it's still in part, and maybe this is all collecting circles, but it's in part because of a small group of people who, like I said, not collusion, but they're all passing the same stuff around. I feel like.
They're the ones into it. They're the ones sort of almost competing with each other, but they're also the ones, though, that have a concerted goal to get this interest going.
Yes.
It's always the same individuals that come up in interviews or talk about this, or the same ones that maybe email Pat asking me when I'm going to sell my games. We're not talking about a lot of people.
No.
We're not. They almost all know a chunk of each other. And again, they all know the people at Heritage Auctions and WADA, and they talk to each other. Like I said, it wasn't a coincidence, in my estimation, that the Pawn Stars segment for the Mike Tyson's Punch-Out comes out the same time two sealed ones were being auctioned at the same time.
Yeah.
I think for this auction, and we'll go over that as well, we'll go over some of the results, what that hit at. So, this copy, interestingly enough, was from the original owner that had purchased it, Christmas gift in 86, placed it in a desk drawer where it remained undisturbed for 35 years, the statement said. This is the New York Times article, did a great job filling in the gaps here. And the New York Times is one of the ones that did the big articles a year ago, pumping up that this is a big thing.
Right.
So that they're part of this public awareness campaign, we'll just say, in order to bring in more interest and awareness in investors. And it has worked to an extent when it comes to this stuff. So the last one, let's see, was $114,000 in July was the last copy, the last Super Mario Brothers that went for a lot of money. So the quote is, it stayed in the bottom of my office desk this whole time since the day I bought it. They asked not to be identified. I never thought anything about it. And then Valerie, who works for Heritage, said that the game was produced in late 86 during a brief period when the games were sealed with plastic shrink wrap rather than sticker seal, and before another packaging variation was introduced in 1987. She says, since the production window for this copy and others like it was so short, finding another copy from the same production run in similar condition would be akin to looking for a single drop of water in an ocean. She said in a statement, never say never, but there's a good chance it can't be done. So what I thought about was, well, I'm going to look at my copies because I always do this. So they're saying there's a small window of time where these were produced. I don't know how they know that.
Sure.
Or what information they have, unless it's from Nintendo directly. I know they talk to each other and things like that. Because I went on my shelf and I had the same copy, obviously not sealed, of the one that sold for $660,000. Where they're looking for copies that do not have, they have a trademark by Super Mario Brothers, but not by Entertainment System. I double, triple checked, and this is the exact copy of the one that went for sale for that amount of money. And then I had another one, Ian, inside my control deck box, which came out in 87.
Right.
Maybe it was early or mid-87, so I don't know how they know this particular thing, but it's not like this is such a rare variant, because I have two of them. And obviously, I know the value is in it being sealed, but like I'm saying, I don't know how they know that. I just don't. Sure. I need someone to explain to me how they know that for sure, that it was a small production window. Because I'm not buying it right now. Because I have, like I said, I have two of them.
Yeah, I'm curious how they know that as well.
I'm very curious. And again, these are people that a few years ago were not in this market.
Right.
That now work for Heritage that are trying to tell me stuff like this. I could be wrong. I'm not saying I'm right, but I need to know more versus just their opinion on it. I do. The auction website allows bidders to make offers to the new owner starting at $990,000 or more. So that's the thing I've seen in Heritage Auction that I don't understand. Where if it's a collector really getting into it, it's still on the site to drive more interest, where you can buy it through the site. So who's purchasing this then?
I think the person's purchasing it and basically immediately relisting it and saying, if I can make this amount of money, I'll take it.
But this is the other interesting part, and this is where I'm not accusing anyone of collusion, but this is where it gets strange, and this is where the information has been known. According to the New York Times, the opening bid at the auction was $310,000. So it wasn't like this started at 99 cents or $1,000. So when you're telling me it starts at this opening bid, why was that price chosen? Who chose it? And who put in these opening bids? Because to me, it's no longer, well, if you get more than at least two people are bidding on it, then that's what it's worth. Well, not so fast. Not if there's people that know other people are bidding on it, and there is some sort of concerted effort to drive the price up, which I'm not saying happened, but this happens on bidding all the time at auctions. I see it at arcade auctions, for God's sake. Protect your investment. Or for pinball machines. Well, someone who owns it or knows someone who owns it, they're going to bid it up to make sure it gets to a certain amount. And when you're saying, well, Pat, why would they do that with a game for this amount of money? Because there's a lot more money at stake than just this one game.
Yes.
A lot more money at stake.
It affects what's...
the other games in the market, other copies that might be produced...
It validates it, so it protects...
It protects the earlier copy that only went for $114. Well, that means, Ian, that one's worth over $1 million. These are the games, the high-stakes games that are played with these sort of people.
Right.
These people that drive these markets and try to pull in other people who can potentially lose money. That's what happens. To the game, again, I have the same materially... This is the same game that auctioned for $660,000. This one doesn't have a nice cellophane. That's the difference when it comes down to it. It's not the same as... Again, it's not the same as comic book collecting. It's not the same.
No.
It's not the same at all. I have two of them. So the article then goes on to say, "This is, in the past year, interest in factory-sealed games has greatly expanded." I would argue that, because when you say expanded, are you talking about price or general interest in the public? If it's still only 200 people buying these things, it's not greatly expanded. It's just more awareness.
Yeah, I think that's particularly important. I think it's I don't know that it's expanded. I think it's just gone up in value.
Collectors have been able to quickly flip titles for thousands of dollars in profits. That's an irresponsible quote by the New York Times. I'll just say that to the author, because there's also people that are trying to buy this stuff that will fail to do so and spending money getting this stuff graded.
Yeah.
So there's always losers when it comes to this stuff. It's an interesting article. Again, it goes into a little bit about what the narrative of Super Mario Brothers is, which is cute. Gives you more background about why it's important. Talks about, you know, the Super Mario Nintendo World opening up and about the popularity of it going for that amount of money. So Miss McLeckley from Heritage said, even so, the degree to which this game was embraced outside the market has been nothing short of exceptional. And that aspect of the sale has certainly exceeded our expectations. Though I suppose we can't be too shocked. Who doesn't love Mario? Well, how can you be shocked when the minimum bid was $310,000? If that's true, according to, I'm going to believe the New York Times. How can you be shocked? If you're going to be shocked, the minimum bid should not have been $310,000. Maybe it should have been $50,000. That's a weird statement. So again, be very careful when you see these articles produced. You have to know who's commenting on them. Are there alternate dissenting opinions that are, and they're almost never presented, which I pointed out multiple times. There's almost never someone saying, whoa, let's pump the brakes slightly here and see what's happening.
Yeah, that's interesting to me. It's always
never a counterpoint. Never.
And I feel like that was different when comics were getting pumped up. I feel like there was more counterpoints even at the time.
Was there? I wasn't paying attention to
it. I feel like that, but I could be wrong.
And there was also the IGN article about it. He said about the trademark or not. It's not like a collector cares if there's a trademark on the box or not, but its ability to use that information to figure out what the earliest printings are. Yes. We don't give a shit about that. But the weird thing about that, our pal Frank Cifoli pointed out, is that this is not the first or second printing of this game.
No, it's like the
fourth. They said
it's
a fourth, at least.
Yeah.
So, at that point, what are you buying? What are you buying at that point?
Mm-hmm.
There's no historical... I never heard of anything else saying, well, this isn't the first or second release of this, Ian, of this book. It's the fourth print of The Little Prince out of Europe.
Because it was only...
It's important because we think for a small window of time. It was important. See the games being played here?
Yeah.
Pardon the pun?
I think that is definitely strange, and that's definitely different than comics. Usually the reprints and things like
are
that
worthless are worthless or not worth as much.
Right.
Or like The Walking Dead or like Ninja Turtles in the 80s did those multiple prints. No one cares past the first print, or maybe the second, I guess, for like the original Ninja Turtles.
For a lot of it, anyways. Yeah. They want first prints. I think that's probably the most interesting thing to me about this, is that there is a constant effort to find collectible reasons for even later printings.
It's weird.
Yeah.
It's weird. Chris said, I think there's people who are jumping on it now thinking it may go up and probably will go up in the future, and also just that they may never have an opportunity to buy one. Well, that could be an argument, but my argument would be, well, why didn't they buy the second print one a year ago for a lot less?
Yeah.
Why didn't they spend the money? If they truly thought this is what they wanted, you would go for the earliest printing as possible and spend less money. That's not a crazy argument.
Maybe it's just FOMO now.
Oh, definitely it's built in. But now we're getting to the point, though, where we should know not necessarily who are purchasing these items, but we have to get to the point of having population reports for these games going forward, like comic books does. They'll let you know, okay, there's a 50 Action Comics number one. These are the number that are graded 9, 8, 7, you know. We have to do that. Otherwise, we won't know if they trickle these out and be like, oh, I got one sitting around sealed, Ian. Maybe I'll get it. I'm saying I have it, but if I had one, I would get it graded immediately to sell it.
Yeah.
And it'd be irresponsible not for the public to know that for some of these games. That, wow, people are spending hundreds of thousands or even $8,000 on a Spider-Man 2600 that maybe WADA has graded 400 of them. So you see what happens to that.
Yeah.
It goes from a $9,000 game to $1,000, but now they're still selling them every month. Not saying it's going to happen with this game, but to be transparent and to know that this isn't just a wild bubble, we should know what's happening here when it comes to this. You want to go through some other sales that just happened for the same auction, just for giggles and
if
laughs?
You want, this stuff makes my eyes glaze over.
But people want to hear about it, Ian. People want to hear about it. And it shows some of the craziness that's happening here. So this was the one that just ended. Let's see. Past sold items. This is from the April 4th auction. By the way, the sealed Mike Tyson's punch out. Right after asking for $100,000 on Pawn Stars, one went for $102,000. What a coincidence, right?
Wow.
A Mega Man sealed second print run went for $144,000. $90,000 for a Pokemon Crystal sealed Game Boy Color. $72,000 for a sealed Pokemon Red. I feel like we've talked about that one multiple times at this point.
Yeah.
There's more than those than you think. A Wright Brothers Super Mario 3, and this is where I say you are going to lose your money. A 9.8 graded sealed Super Mario Brothers 3, not the first print, went for $52,800. 9.8, probably pulled from a carton. Probably. I'm not saying it did for sure. $50,000 for a sealed Final Fantasy 3 on Super Nintendo. Craziness. This one's interesting because this one's actually harder to find. A sealed John Madden championship, not super rare, but the rental Genesis one, championship edition. Oh. I got on the shelf. $50,000 for that. That's a weird one because, again, this is like, well, it's actually hard to find, but most people don't care. There's nothing really special outside of it being, well, it's a limited release of it. It's a weird one. Tengen Tetris, $36,000 sealed on the NES. Then you get to the really, really, really stupid, crazy stuff, like the collector's edition of a sealed Ocarina of Time going for $31,000. I think I know someone who has that. Our buddy Karnov, who I brought up last week, sealed for $28,800. I mean, I love Karnov. No one, not many people love
Karnov. No one loves Karnov that much.
Not that much. I wanted the remake of that. Tomb Raider, a Tomb Raider PlayStation, first production, $26,000.
Nuts.
And then there's other ones. This is how you know it's weird. Like Super Mario Brothers, there was two other Super Mario Brothers 3 in the same auction, $21,000. And then the Left Bros went for the least amount of money, $19,000, even though it's a smaller, lesser grade, but that's actually the first run. Nothing lines up in this market.
No,
there's so much weirdness going on. I'm like, this is why I say, like, I would not be surprised if there's collusion, because it doesn't make any sense anymore. If a third or fourth print Ninja Turtles number one in a better condition go for almost three times the amount of the first edition in a slightly less grade, it doesn't make any sense.
It wouldn't make any sense, yeah.
It doesn't make any sense anymore. Oh, that great Mortal Kombat for Super Nintendo, the edition we all love and cherish, went for $19,000.
Ah, yes.
The most garbage version of that game.
Yeah.
Like, it's garbage. So, this is given another, shot in the arm. And there's more. I mean, a Pokemon Gold for $13,200. I have one sealed. It's not a 9.6. I got one sealed later on. All right, here's the one that I wanted to get to. Because this is the first TurboGrafx one I remember seeing.
Yeah.
This is one we should talk about. Bonk's Adventure, a 9.8, went for $11,400. This is the first time I can remember WADA doing a TurboGrafx one, or at least one that was a Bonk. So when you talk about TurboGrafx 16, for historic value, there are maybe three games that you can talk about, at least for North America. Bonk, Splatterhouse, maybe Legendary Axe, or maybe Blazing Lasers. Like but that's it. That's really it.
I think Bonk and Splatterhouse. Really, I think you're stretching for a third. At least
I'm trying.
That's like publicly.
Like Legendary Axe had its own commercials. You know what I mean? It was a big title for it, as much as you can say.
Great game.
Blazing Lasers became a later pack-in title, but that's it. So this went for $11,400 when I had a TurboGrafx collector say, wow, that's like a $500 game in my world, a sealed Bonk. Historically, sealed Turbo games have not gone for a huge amount of money.
No.
And in this auction, you see them try to compare it to this is a Super Mario Brothers of the TurboGrafx. But the awareness of Bonk is so low in the public eye that this isn't like, well, you know, most people know who Mario was, even your next door neighbor who's 70 years old. They would not know who Bonk was. Like, they wouldn't. They would. It's not really a legacy that's known in the public. But what's interesting about this is that there's a sticker on this that says Free Bonk, So this copy was laying around in NDC's warehouse, and this was not like one that first came out. That was saying, get a free bunk. You know, that would have been later on.
Right.
Because the free bunk, was that the sequel? I have no idea. Because the copies I've seen usually don't have that. So it's just interesting when you see what's happening here. That we're trying to make this bunk the new Super Mario Brothers. And like I said, I don't own... I'll be totally transparent. I own a Seal Splatterhouse. If I'm trying to pump that up, like I said, I'll be transparent. I own a Seal Splatterhouse. I do not own a sealed bunk. But it's interesting to see it go for that much, that little guy.
Yeah, I would not have expected that.
So that was a sort of a shock to me to see. If it was like $2,000, I'd be like, okay, it's interesting, but for that amount of money. But then again, I guess all bets are off at this point.
If people are
spending $10,000 on a San Andreas for PS2, I mean, all bets are off.
Anything like, can go like for anything.
This, I'm looking down this list, Ian. It's insane. It's just not... Some of this is not lining up in my head at all when it comes to this. Not just because of the titles chosen, because of the eras. Tekken 3, $6,600. Tekken 3. Three! Not even one. Three. Okay, this one I know someone definitely has. I've seen it. Someone had this. A sealed Majora's Mask. $5,700. I know someone that has one of those, for sure. So everyone out there, go get that money. How about that factory sealed case of 6 Perfect Darks? That it's so easy to find a sealed Perfect Dark. Everyone has one. $4,800 for a pack of 6 sealed ones. That's nuts.
It's wild.
All right, we can go on more, but there's too many to talk about.
Yes,
at this point. So congratulations to everyone who's making the money at Heritage Auctions. And WADA, you've got your people in the market now that are buying this stuff to throw in a closet, to throw their extra money in, their investment dollars that they have laying around. And I guess we'll see where this leads over the next few years if this market remains established. Because I just know in some future time, Ian, someone's going to want a sealed NBA Action 98 on the Sega Saturn.
Ah, who doesn't want that?
They're gonna want that one. That's a title we've always talked about before. And last but not least, I have to bring these up because it's funny to see. The first time I've seen sealed consoles for auction or new open box. I've owned a new open box action set at one point. I almost couldn't give away for more than what I thought it was. So a new open box Super Nintendo. The original looks like release went for $3,100, and a sealed ColecoVision went for $3,200. Wow. Okay. I do have a couple of basically brand new old ass consoles laying around from the early 80s, but I don't think I could sell my Intellivision 2 for that much money. That's brand new. I don't think that's going to be a thing.
No, I don't think.
Something tells me that won't be a thing. Oh, our favorite color dinosaur went for $2,600.
Ah.
That's the gem right there. That's the gem. This segment of the CU Podcast is sponsored by NordVPN. It's what I use to keep myself safe online, and you can too. If you care about the security and safety of your online presence, take control of your internet experience today with NordVPN. I've used NordVPN when traveling, at the airport, when accessing public Wi-Fi, at a restaurant, or even when I just want internet privacy at home.
With NordVPN, all of your internet data stays safe behind a wall of next-generation encryption. And they change your IP twice to cover your web traffic with an extra layer of security. They have a strict no-logs policy. They don't track, collect, or share your private data. It's none of their business. Choose from 5,400-plus servers in 59 countries. Enjoy the internet with no limits or borders. One account lets you connect up to 6 devices, secure them all in any combination. It's just a click. Using NordVPN is as simple and intuitive as making your morning coffee.
That's simple, Ian.
That easy.
Take control of your internet experience today with NordVPN. Right now you can get a 2-year plan at a huge discount at nordvpn.com/CU podcast. And when you use code CU podcast, you'll get another additional month free. It's risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's nordvpn.com/CU podcast to take control of your internet again. All right, Ian.
Pat.
You work at an independent game store.
I do work at an independent game store.
You help run the show. You've done it now for, what, over 12 years? 13?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, I think close to 14 years, actually.
And you've seen the highs and the lows and the price trends and the pre-pandemic prices, COVID reigniting some interest in consoles. So it's interesting then to see a Wired article come out asking or stating independent video game stores are here to stay. Despite rising digital sales in the pandemic, retro gaming and tight-knit clienteles are keeping smaller shops alive while other retailers falter.
So this is an interesting article because the pandemic has had a huge impact on small video game stores. I can't say universally, but I am willing to bet that the majority of independent game stores out there that are well run, keep regular hours, and you know, it's a business less than a hobby. I would assume that most of them have seen a large increase in profits over the past year. So it's, this article is interesting to me because if the pandemic had never happened, I'm not sure we would be having this article would be the same.
I don't think so.
I don't always necessarily agree with the doom and gloom aspect, or the doom and gloom viewpoint that independent stores are going to die
in general.
I don't think that independent video game stores are necessarily on their way out. I think the boom for independent video game stores is over.
We're 5 years past that.
Yeah, far past that. But when you look at something like, say, Not For Resale, I don't think it's... What would you say the overall view of Not For Resale was? That this
documentary executive produced?
Yeah.
There's an end point to this. And the retail shop owner said that directly, on and off camera. Like, there's an end point in time when the value of physical media stops being a thing. By generation, it just stops being collected to the same extent or bought. So there is a natural end point when it comes to this via the consoles themselves. So it may not be next year. Could be 5 years, 10 years. There will be less interest overall, and that I do in general agree with. And we've seen it in other hobbies where there's a retraction of whether it's model trains or models in general, where generationally there's just less interest and it goes away. Not saying they all go away, but a chunk go away.
No,
and in the documentary itself, before we ended post production, three of the stores that were interviewed went out of business by the time they were interviewed versus sure. when it came out. So I'm not saying they're all the same effect, but it's not nothing.
I think there's an end point, but I think there's always going to be a market for some. It just depends on how well some of these are run compared to the others. I think some of them are more set up for
success.
For success.
They have a better outreach,
for a longer run.
Better clientele, sort of better communication.
I agree that there's an end point. I just don't know if it's that soon. Anyway, so what this is talking about is how basically... and this is a lot of stuff that I've said before, that even though digital sales are taking over how games are sold, that is not really affecting these stores yet because they are selling things that are not really... even though they're all video games, it's two different markets. There's the physical market, and then there's the digital market. And it is getting harder to bring people into a store for modern games, but it's been very easy over the past year at least to bring people into the store for old games. People have wanted something comforting, they've wanted nostalgia, they've wanted something sure. that is familiar. So that's where we've seen a lot of this business. And
but that was an extraordinary circumstance over the past year.
Sure, but it's still
something that is real and palpable, and people are
you can sit on
it.
Your ass sure. at home and you can order it offline, or you can go to the store and get it, but you can't turn on your video game system and say, give me this, and have it delivered directly to you. And I think some people like leaving
for the old stuff.
Yes, people want the, especially during something like the pandemic where you're feeling crazy and you haven't been going out and doing stuff. You want that instant gratification. You get that idea that you want to play Sega Genesis. You're going to go out, and if you can, you're going to go to a local store and you're going to buy that Genesis instead of ordering it off the internet.
So you've said on the podcast that in the pandemic, you had people come in and say, give me literally any console. There PlayStation, Genesis, what do you got?
It's not like they were like, give me anything, but people will come in and they'll run down a list of like three things and they'll leave with their third choice.
So the year before, we'll just say in 2019, what percentage of people were doing that versus afterwards where they had a list of of, we'll just say, acceptable consoles that they would walk home with versus a particular one?
I think it depends on the shopper, but it's always going to be far less than it was.
Sure.
This is,
so something happened last year, obviously, people at home, more yes. time on their hand, maybe stimulus money, where I want to reconnect with this because it was not trending in that direction for certain consoles.
Sure.
For years and years.
So
we talked about that before.
But like I said, it's still people come in, they like to browse, they like to talk. It's why record stores exist. It's why people don't do all of their record ordering online. But it's odd. So the whole basis of the whole title, independent video game stores are here to stay. I don't think they're going anywhere soon. I think you have to specify what you mean by independent video game stores, though. Ones that focus mostly on retro, I think, actually will be around longer than ones that tried to be a direct competitor to GameStop. The article actually mentions, the scenario that we always encounter. It's that you kind of end up forming an unofficial alliance with your local GameStop. They're not coming into, people aren't coming to your store to look for what GameStop has, and GameStop doesn't have what you have.
Sure. Real quick, I do know one, it's not evidence, but I do know one store I did close last year during the pandemic. I think they closed in the summer. I won't say who, but I do know one. I'm also not going to say that, well, a lot of small businesses suffered. A lot, basically, though, got, money to help pay employees and stay open. Money that was basically like a free loan to help. So I'm not saying without that they would have closed. It definitely helped help businesses stay afloat during it.
Sure.
So it kind of maybe hopefully it balanced it out, because obviously with the pandemic being closed, some would have closed. So maybe it balanced out, but I don't have the data on that. How do you measure that? How do you measure ones that would have closed anyway or got an extra shot in the arm? I don't know.
Right.
But you have to bring it up, because a lot of places did get basically free money to stay open and pay employees. So they talked to Josh from SideQuest. We brought him up before. He shipped me that nice Mario behind you.
Right.
Find My Keys Mario. His store is in Portland. He said, in the past few years, Josh has not been too concerned about the digitalization of games and big box competition. In fact, selling retro games in the storefront has been so profitable, it made him quit his original day job working as a car salesman. I wonder, though, if this will help, because what we said at this point, and for years, Ian already said, do not open up a retro game store. Do not open it brand new at this point.
No, you can't open one brand new, because there's no way to acquire the back stock. There's no way to get the stock for a reasonable price.
Unless you
already have it.
And it sounds like Josh had that when he first started. So that almost everyone has to have that to get into retro. Like how do you get into it if you don't have a collection? It's kind of tough to acquire that stock, especially because you bought the stock for pennies and the dollar over decades, like a lot of these collectors did. Like Jeff Santulli was collecting since the 80s, so he opens a store. It makes sense. They talked to Dave Kalin of Game Over Video Games in Austin, Texas. I feel like I've met him probably at some point at some convention. He started his business in 2005, long before the days of easy Amazon buys and digital downloads. Since then, his small store has expanded to over a dozen locations throughout Texas. Wow.
That's a lot.
Okay, I believe David runs the Classic Game Fest. I believe that's that same David. Okay, yes, I met him. He says the secret to business survival is the need for social interaction amongst gamers. Whereas Amazon and major retailers might offer easy online purchases, David is convinced that a store has flourished by prioritizing the in-person experience. Well, they're also offering different things. For Amazon, you're not going to Amazon to buy old retro games for the most part. You're coming to the store. For us, our relationships with customers doesn't just end at them buying a game. We want to start a conversation with folks about games and create a place to go hang out. Gamers, just like everyone else, need social interactions too. I would bother Ian for hours at a time. That's why the podcast started. I'd go to Ian and we'd talk for like an hour and a half. In between customers. Yeah, talk about shit.
You can't downplay the importance of the social interaction, but that is also something that I think that has been very heightened in the past year.
Sure.
People look forward to going to stores that they truly enjoy going to, because even the people who are, being responsible and are in and out and, minding how many people are in the store, they need some social interaction. Some of the only outside trips that I've done that are outside of groceries and work during the pandemic were, I've been making like a once a month trip to the local record store, because it's nice to shoot the shit with Michael for a little bit and pick up some music. I could do it online. I don't need to ever leave.
So you became the Pat to the Ian in the store. You're not talking to him. before.
Yeah, and I don't talk much, but it's just nice to to be in the same room with someone else who, like, if I have a question about this, I can ask him, and he's going to know. So
Ian, you cherish our old talks at the old Voltaire shop, and at I used to love the Newport location so much.
The Newport location?
Well, I just liked the fact that it was right there.
I liked the Voltaire location.
Well, I like both. Yeah. But, I mean, I like being able to walk and see you on a Wednesday or with Frank drunkenly going,
sure.
Hey, Harvey Birdman game.
Yeah, on Wednesdays, that was always nice.
And then we give you a ride home.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, that was nice, too. Fun. That was always fun. Save me the Lyft or the Uber. Yeah, that was the thing that we do. Every Friday, I give Ian a ride home. For like, yeah, most of them, it was great.
Yeah.
If we were there until 8. Then famously one time, I just got to tell this story because this shows how ornery Frank is. A nice guy. He gets ornery when he drinks sometimes.
Yes, he does.
Ornery. He gets a little bit bad, I'll just say. Now, I don't want to destroy your image of Frank. So the one time we're driving back, this is probably like 2015 or so, 16. I'll never forget this. He knows the story.
Yes.
I was going to say, I'll pick Ian up at 8. I just go down to Frank. We go down to the bar. We have a dinner.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like 2 miles away from Ian going back towards to go to Frank. So usually hang out with Frank and for a little bit afterwards. I go, oh, no, Frank, I got to turn around and pick up Ian. I forgot. And Frank was like, nah, I'm not doing that. Stop. Got out of the car about 4 miles from his house. Three like 5 miles at night. He did not want to wait for me to turn around and pick up Ian, which would have took 5 minutes.
We're talking a few blocks.
Yeah. Like 12 blocks.
Yeah.
Like, he did not want me to wait. And so I went back to pick up Ian, and Ian's like, where's Frank? Oh, no, he jumped out of the car.
Yeah, he
to walk
got
home.
Out of the car and walked home.
Because he did not want to wait. So I picture, by the time me picking up Ian to drop him off, he probably would not have reached his house. By then.
Oh, no. Yeah, he was probably waiting. It probably took him forever.
He probably had another mile to go at that point. It's just a funny story. I don't think I told that on the podcast before or not a long time, but I'll never forget that, speaking of local game stores, when it comes to that. And they talked to a couple other owners, an owner in Albuquerque and another one, J&L Games. So, like I said, it's kind of it'll be a weird sort of thing because we don't know where we'd be at if we didn't have a 100-year pandemic event to sort of give this a weird social shot in the arm and people having stimulus money. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We don't know. But I'm happy. It's good. But I'm still not bullish over the long term
I'm
a lot of these shops.
I'm more positive on it, I think, than
you're
you
more positive
are.
Because of this event?
No. I think I'm more positive on it than you are. But I think this article is taking a lot of the good business that we got from the pandemic, and it's extrapolating it to mean a little bit more than I think
it's not putting it in its proper place.
Yeah, I don't think it's in the proper context. That's it.
Because there was that point in time where you looked in the back of your shop and you'd have, you know, 20 Super Mario 3s sitting there, 25
sure.
of them. So, like, we're talking about a time when, like, people didn't want these popular games, and now a weird event happens, you couldn't keep that in the store potentially because people are like, oh, I want to play that. I'll buy the Retron HD and I'll get the Super Mario 3.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just the reality of it. We look at the price charting prices on these games, and it's in black and white. Summer 2016 was the peak. After that, game prices go down for a lot of these 80s and 90s consoles. We're not even talking about the pre-NES, which is always garbage. I don't think people are running out to buy, you know, Atari 2600 games during the pandemic. That didn't make the crossover.
Sold more of them during the pandemic than I have in the past few years.
All right.
Literally, I've just sold more of everything than I have in the past few years. Nothing.
It's a special, not nothing.
Hasn't been popular.
It's a special type of desperation. You're like, I gotta play Centipede on the 2600. Give me that card. Let me rummage through the dollar box, rummage through the dollar bin and get those copies. All right. Ian.
Pat.
We have a Patreon, don't we?
We do. Why don't you tell people about it, Pat?
Oh, you go to patreon.com/CUpodcast and you give us monies and we give you stuff. And that's what you say.
That's about right.
You have a weekly writing that my partner does.
That's right. I got to do one today.
And then we have a monthly Ian hangout. I pop in sometimes just to say hello on that, but not usually. And then we have, you get the this topic early at the Patreon poll topic you vote on, and you get the full video for your enjoyment.
Full video.
But our poll this week was a 60-40 split. I was like a 60-40 split because it's a lot closer statistically.
60-40 is nice. Yeah,
nice split. So it's like a 5 10 point swing in one direction. In second place, do big video game releases get too much hype? 40%. We will do that topic eventually.
Yep.
We're not just keep pulling that back for a reason. And in first place, this goes back to the previous WADA topic and the Super Mario Brothers that went for $660,000. Do you have concerns about a retro game crash due to, I guess, grading and this auction phenomenon?
Yes, I do think there will be a crash. And it's not going to be for everything. I know I've said this before on the podcast. Certain things, I think there is a good chance that Mario's, Zelda's, Mike Tyson's will maintain a high price. I think Mario in particular can potentially maintain a high price. I think all of the chaff, all of the fucking...
The other 90%.
All of the... Yeah,
I don't... All the car knobs...
All of the mid-tier stuff is absolutely not going to maintain this value.
Color a dinosaur?
And I think one of the things we can look at and see where that is happening is you look... Because it's one that I've always brought up since we started doing this. It's the Spider-Mans. Stuff like that... Even Spider-Man, as big as Spider-Man is, in the fact that there are collectors who will collect anything Spider-Man, it doesn't matter what it is, we saw those prices start to tumble down as more and more...
9,000, 7,000, 6,000, 5,000, down to a 1,000. And there's, but that could be a more special case because those are way more common than people think. But it still shows you that, well... It could happen to a game like Spider-Man that has, with an iconic character. Is there any hope then for, I don't know, Cabal then, if Spider-Man tumbles like that?
No. And I think we may not have seen the highest prices that some of these go for, but we're already starting to see crazy prices for things that it doesn't make any sense.
Doesn't make any sense, not just for the availability or rarity of the game, but also for the title itself. Like, there's nothing to justify one or the other. It's just the fact that, well, it's from the same era. If they're treating it like a Golden Age comic. It's from the same era. Even though it's an off thing, I should get it just in case, maybe.
20 years from now, 10 years from now, I could see something like a Super Mario Brothers, especially like the first run, whatever, or sticker seal. I could see that holding on to its value and having some cachet. I don't see a lot of these other titles holding anything. So yes, I do think there is going to be a crash. I don't think the money that is currently in this is going to be the money that's always there.
This question, though, is also saying, well, is this going to also help crash the retro game market in general? This originally came from a Q&A on Twitter where it said, any concerns about greatest stuff, we'll see a major crash of all retro GameCube and earlier that isn't rare, similar to comics. So we're bringing up stuff that isn't rare, that's graded, that we're like, well, I can say absolutely I don't see a sealed Robo Demons going for a ton of money in the future, or I'm looking at like a sealed Goonies 2. There won't be enough people that are going to care about it. They're talking about also the other markets, but I think they're so distinct.
Yes.
Still, that they've pulled up the complete in box market to an extent I did not believe I'd ever see a fucking Contra complete in box go for $1,500 in my life. The one I have on my shelf, that I never thought I'd see in my life.
Right.
But I still don't see that happening even for that stuff. I don't see that being sustainable.
No, I don't think
especially
that's
because this stuff is a lot easier to find. It's not hard to find a Contra complete in box or Mike Tyson's Punch Out complete in box. It's not hard at all. So I don't see the numbers, like I don't see that happening over time.
Yeah,
there's too many in people's collections. There's too many of them.
Right. So I really don't think it's going to. I don't think the sealed and graded market will have any impact whatsoever on the
cartridges or
the loose market. The cartridges that we've seen that they play by completely different rules,
or even complete in box. I think it will.
No, I don't. I don't think it's going to really affect that either.
I don't see someone having a sealed Rygar that goes for $8,000 bringing up the complete in box that much.
No,
it had to be a very particular thing. Like it's happened with Legend of Zelda. Like I said, like I think I can get $1,000 now or several hundred for the first print run of complete in box. This is nuts.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And then. A game like Mike Tyson's Punch-Out has gone up a lot, but it's like that handful of titles.
Mm-hmm.
Which could be the same thing for the sealed stuff. It's going to be like the handful of titles, maybe from each console, depending upon the availability. But they said about before GameCube, which is interesting, because that, again, is a point in time where, like, okay, once you get to, like, the turn of the century, it's a bit easier to find the sealed stuff laying around. Mm-hmm. It's a bit easier to find that stuff because it's not... It was cheaper to produce them too, than those disc based games.
Oh yeah, right? Absolutely.
It's just easier to find.
Pressing a CD is a lot cheaper than making a cartridge.
And that's where we're not talking about a far long point in time where people weren't tossing those things out. Okay, well, I gotta hold on to this stuff just in case. And plus that's a point in time where people probably started to realize maybe I should buy an extra copy just in case.
Right.
You know, that's not too crazy to think about the GameCube era, PS2, where this might be a big game. You know,
I think a lot of that started during the DS era too, especially with publishers like Atlas. You know, some of the stuff they published on the PS2 and on the DS was hard to find. And so I think people started thinking, hey, with this Atlas stuff, we're going to start buying extra copies. And sure. That's when Atlas realized, hey, we can also just increase the amount of copies we made. So very quickly, a lot of people stopped doing that because they realized they didn't need to.
Yeah. And these companies, even over the past 4 or 5 years, were still printing out some PS2 games.
Yeah.
Which is kind of weird to think about. But, you know, like, oh, we're going to do another run. Talk about the Yakuza game we talked about. And a couple others, right?
For instance, Yakuza did get those second print runs,
which is kind of weird. It's just kind of weird. It's like, wow, the system's dead, but we're going to make more of them and put them out. I don't know if they're talking about though for this question, sealed like GameCube games, like graded GameCube games. If that's a thing, there has been a lot of those that I've seen for sale on Heritage auctions. They're definitely on eBay, but I don't know if that's going to be a thing. I don't know.
Yeah, not certain.
I just don't know if someone's going to spend $5,500 on a sealed Pikmin 2. Yeah, I don't know. I do know this, though. I do know if you're talking to someone at the swap meet, he's like, yeah, GameCube in general is so meteoric right now, and the price is going up.
It's insane.
Where I actually got out my game list, which I'll go over right now. I have all of the popular titles on the GameCube. I have all the ones that you expect. Okay, like the Mario Parties and, you know, the Wave Race and the F-Zero and the Sunshine. And when I started going over the prices on those, I was, shocked.
Yes.
And even the ones that were kind of weird. Where are my GameCube games? So,
it's absolutely through the roof.
Because it's 20 years later, right? It hits that point in time. Where were NES games?
Yeah, but it also...
Is there something else going on with the GameCube in particular?
GameCube hit when the pandemic hit, so it...
It was already going up before that, though,
it
right?
was, but the pandemic really skyrocketed it. Like, we're seeing explosion in GameCube, certain GameCube game prices, like we saw on the Dreamcast and the Saturn, and they should not be like that.
Because they're more common.
Yes. I don't think we're ever going to get to those high prices, but yes, so many games, just like literally everything on the GameCube that comes in these days, we have to check. Everything.
Eternal Darkness. That's the one someone said, look at what Eternal Darkness is going for.
That I don't think is going for as crazy as I would think, but it's still up there.
12 bids, $95 with a day left.
Okay, under 150 would be not crazy.
Okay, so 150 is your cutoff?
Once a game gets above 150, that's when I think it's extreme.
Okay, I was going to say 100 for some of these games.
It is, but if you do that, then suddenly you're looking at so much of the GameCube library at this point.
But that's my point, though.
Yeah.
It's the only console I've heard of where the most common titles are going for $100. Like, we never saw that for, Super Mario World and, you know what I mean, and, Super Metroid.
I don't think the most common titles are going for that, but anything under very common is up
well,
there.
Okay, well, maybe you don't count Smash Melee because that was always a special case.
Has always been about $60.
But that's probably a lot more right now. But what about Double Dash?
Double Dash is probably going for probably about $80.
That's a lot for a common.
Or
game.
It was. It may be going down.
That's a lot to me for a common. $72. Oh, no, manual, $72.
But you look at stuff like Lost Kingdom 2.
What game is that?
It's Lost Kingdom 2.
Okay.
look at a game like Lost Kingdom 2. Look at games like Go Go Hyper Grind. Look at the...
What's Mary Kate going for?
Sorry, look at the muscle games.
Mary Kate's only going for $10 right now, unfortunately. I got that one locked up. How about Odama? That's that weird one.
That's the pinball one. I don't think that goes for much because you need the microphone to play it.
That I've seen at the swap meet 3 times. I bought it the first time.
But it wouldn't surprise me if it's going for a lot because everything is going for a lot.
No, it's not going for a lot, it looks like. You can buy it now for $50. I guess, that's not to buy it now with the microphone. Did it come with the microphone? No, you just got to have it separately. On that one, but okay, we're getting off topic. But I was just shocked that some of them, even like the Wave Race and F-Zero, were like
Oh yeah, F-Zero's up there. F-Zero's definitely up there.
I just never saw it before another Nintendo system. We just haven't. Again, yeah. Where all these like the ones that you were bound to have are worth a lot of money.
Yeah.
Like as if they were like uncommon or rare.
Mm-hmm.
Just haven't seen it. GameCube's that weird thing. It goes back to the point that we always kind of said, like, well, every Nintendo console, for whatever reason, is going to have collectability to it just because it's Nintendo. It's just a weird thing. More so than the other consoles. Like, the popular titles are more collectible because Nintendo's still around and still doing those franchises. Except for F-Zero, for some reason, and Wave Race. Come on. Give me a Wave Race on the Switch. It'd be fantastic.
I'd play it.
We'd all play it. But anyway, going back to the graded stuff, though. It's always going to be separate, or I don't think it's going to crash the things.
I don't think they're really going to touch each other.
Because, again, it has not brought up the cartridges really at all. And only very few complete in boxes. Getting off topic there. But okay, I'll shut up. All right, Ian, we got voicemails to listen to.
We do.
You can go to anchor.fm/theCUpodcast. Leave us a short one. Like, hey, guys, I'm from here, and here's my question. Pat, your hair sucks, whatever. But make it quick. Quicker the better. More likely to get you on the air there. Okay, here is the first one.
Hi, guys. This is Jacopo from Italy, and here's my question. So I've worked in an Italian university for years, and every year I saw dozens of new courses like cinema, modern music, and whatnot. So I was wondering, and I'm sure you're the most knowledgeable people to ask, maybe, don't you think that also video games, history of video game, or something like that should become a proper academic course? Thanks, and congrats for the podcast.
Jacopo's giving us way too much credit, Paisa.
Too much credit.
Way too much credit with the ones. From my limited knowledge, it has seen an uptick in university and college.
I'm glad we paused for that.
I'm glad we did too. But it has. Maybe not that I know, like Harvard's doing it, but we do know people that are involved with this, that it has.
Yeah. No, we've got like our friend Daniel.
Good pal Daniel.
Good
salt,
pal Daniel.
Salt of the earth. Part of Team Sushi.
Good guy.
Hashtag Team Sushi. Yeah. We've seen it. I think give it another 5-10 years, it'll slowly roll out more, because probably before the past 10 years, there probably wasn't anything going on or very little. So it's like anything else. It takes time to integrate. And
yes,
we're not a lot of generations removed from people totally growing up with video games. We're like only a couple generations.
Yeah.
So Gen X and millennials was the first ones that, like, okay, I grew up and were playing games when I was 3 or 4.
Mm-hmm.
So give it time. The same way probably was given time for TV and film studies.
Exactly.
There probably wasn't TV and film classes in the 30s and 40s. It probably took some time to get there.
We will definitely get to the point where it's a very common topic and subject.
Yeah. The next question here.
Hey, guys. So in middle school, high school, and college, all the way up until now, I graduate in a couple months, I've taken Japanese class. The only reason I've taken Japanese class is so that I can play Japanese video games without having to struggle through guides translating to English for me.
That's dedication.
So I'm wondering, what is the most extreme thing you guys have done in order to play certain video games?
Printing out 100 pages dot matrix printer for Fire Pro 6-minute scramble.
Yeah.
I forgot where I got that printed, but it was a dot matrix printer. It wasn't even like a laser or bubble jet. I remember that.
I think that's honestly probably the craziest for me, as I remember printing
stapling that fucking thing.
Printing the, this was before there were like websites with pictures and Google Translate was an easy thing, and you could just hold your phone up to a TV screen. No, I remember printing out a Fire Pro G guide that was literally like 56 pages long. Probably 2/3 of that dedicated to translating all of the move names.
Creator Wrestler?
All the Creator Wrestler stuff.
Well, the move names you didn't need because you had the demo, but you needed like the logic. You needed that shit. Like, oh, turnbuckle move logic, outside the ring logic. You needed that stuff. You couldn't do your wrestler without that, yeah.
And then I guess, other than that, I have a CRT TV in my house that we talked about before. I hook up some of my older systems on it, but that CRT TV I have kept around specifically so I can play the Bust a Groove games, the Bust a Move in Japan games, the rhythm games they literally, playing them on an HDTV is just about impossible. There's no way to do it.
Wow.
It just does not sync up properly. So I do lug a CRT, I've lugged a CRT TV to 2 different apartments here just so I can keep playing this.
Most extreme thing we do is every NES marathon, Pat's gonna lug everything's been that to set it up, and that's a myriad and puzzle of wires that in past years I've Thankfully, Ian thanks me. I keep him away from the setup part because that was always the most stressful part.
It's the worst.
And nowadays, I'm more like the last one we did. I was like, remember I did it like last minute because like the other solution didn't work. The we tried to use an LCD TV and it was not working.
It's just not going to happen.
Just like, fuck it. We're going old school. I got it set up within an hour and it worked. Like, unlike past years where I'm stressing about it.
It was very good.
I said, Ian, I got it done. Like, I was in the zone finally. It took 10 years, but I got it done.
I'm so proud of you.
Thanks, Ian.
You're welcome.
We had a moment there.
Wait, no, Pat. Ian, this is Josh from China. Moved here, obviously. I was listening back to an older episode, and you guys were talking about the Warrior 64. The reason they're able to sell them cannibalized so cheap is, like, if I go on Taobao here, I can get one for 28 kwai, which is 7 kwai is $1. So, and, like, if I go to a local store, I can get one for, like, 25. If I go down to Shenzhen, which is next to Hong Kong, they're, like, 16, 18 kwai. So, like, they're super cheap. So it's very easy for them to sell.
Okay, so that...
On the Indiegogo or Kickstarter or whatever it
was. Okay, so that's a topic from a few months ago. Thanks, Josh. Good luck in China. I'm surprised they had the N64 there, because I know they had the remake, or the was it the Q one,
yeah,
which was special. I didn't know they had regular N64s in China.
I mean, over time, I'm sure electronics can go any number of places.
So for $4 each, yes, that makes sense if that's where
that
they got it.
That suddenly makes sense.
Yeah. We were thinking Japan, maybe they're like $10, $15, but $4, that's
insane. You certainly couldn't do it in the U.S. That was my point. You definitely couldn't do it in the U.S. I figured it must have been something like that.
No.
Hey guys, how's it going?
Good.
I know that both of you guys have said many times that you guys don't know a lot about the Game Boy Advance's library. There are probably about 1,500 games on the Game Boy Advance.
Jesus. So many.
A little under 1,400 of them are ports, whether that be remakes or just regular ports.
1,400?
So there's a good chance that you guys probably know a bit more about the Game Boy Advance's library than you realize. With that said, is there any chance for there to be a certain guidebook on the Game Boy, more specifically the Game Boy Advance?
More specifically, no on the Game Boy Advance. Because the idea of doing a book with 1,500 games in it makes my skin crawl.
Yeah.
To do that. It's tough enough doing one with 800 games with half of that. That takes years. And unless you're just doing a simple description of the games, which I refuse to do because that's not a review book, that's an undertaking I don't think anyone will ever do, not just me. I don't think you'll ever see a proper review book of something that has that many games. That's just ridiculous.
There's
too many.
There's just too much. There's too much shovelware. It wouldn't be fun. That would kill anyone who went through it.
But that would also be a book that would be ridiculously, I mean, if again, unless you did like 4 per page.
Yeah.
Which I guess you could, but then you're not giving enough. Not to get into the competitors. My books are the only ones that do an actual full review of every single game. Like, sure. Actually play through the games and review them properly. Because, you know why? It's tough work, and it stinks, and it takes a lot of time. And it's infuriating to have to play really bad games in order to review them.
Right.
Anyone can play the good games. Be like, oh, yeah, I played through Ocarina of Time. Now play through, like, Xena, Warrior Princess on the N64, or have someone do it. Now that takes a special type of person to get through that and to do it academically as best they can.
Yeah.
And give them, and not just give up. You know what I mean? So that's what I mean. But regular Game Boy, I could see, because that's a smaller library. That's reasonable. I also don't think there's this love for the Game Boy Advance, probably because of what he said. He mentioned
there's a huge love for the Game Boy Advance. Well, people love it, but they don't have a love for the entirety of the library.
Because a lot of those games, like you said, you could get them elsewhere, or they're ports, or you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
They're retreads at that point. But thank you so much for the question there, Nathaniel. Next.
Hey guys, John from Canada. During the Zelda anniversary, some friends and I were remembering that for a good couple of years, if you had a GameCube with the Game Boy player, you could play a version of every single Zelda game released to that point.
Wow.
Do you think that we'll get to that point with any other franchises on the Switch or maybe other consoles? Thank you.
No, I don't think we will.
Games now. Those franchises.
But you could via the virtual console or something like that. I just don't think Nintendo has the fucking interest in it. I don't think they can.
I mean, are they interested in saying, well, we're going to re-release the last 17 Zelda games versus pushing the new stuff on you? I mean, it's all about the money. It's like we want everyone to buy the $60 Breath of the Wild 2. We don't care about you playing a 15-year-old Zelda game to that extent, because that's not how we're making our money.
They couldn't even put the second Mario Galaxy on the 3D All-Stars.
Exactly.
So, no, I don't. I mean, as much as I would like that, no, I don't think we will get to that point. That's something that Microsoft, I think, is the company that is going to be the company that is going to try to make sure that their legacy series are always available to be played in some way, shape, or another on a Microsoft system. Microsoft,
or,
I think,
or
is
Game Pass or whatever.
I think Microsoft is going to make sure at all times on any Xbox that is current, you are going to be able to play, for instance, everything that's in the Halo series.
Sure.
Nintendo, I don't think, has any interest in making sure that you can play everything in the Zelda series.
On each system, but yep, going forward.
Hey, Pat and Ian. This is Nick from Seattle. Just wondering if you guys have ever had a game that you liked the music so much, you would just boot it up and go to the sound test and kind of just listen to the music. For me, it would be Sonic 2. It's my fondest memory. Thanks, guys.
I don't know why more games didn't do the sound test. Well, most games don't have a sound test. I don't know why more didn't do it, because they're great little bonuses to have at the time.
There are games that I definitely have played because I was like, you know what, the music would be fun right now. Streets of Rage is a game that I've definitely done that with, especially like the earlier ones in the series. I might just fire them up and play. I just can't remember. Not every game, surprisingly few games have a sound test. Like, I feel like they all should have had them.
By the 16-bit era, they should have had them, probably.
I feel like a lot more Sega games did, but I can't say specifically, you know, if there was a game that I booted up specifically
I remember
a sound test.
Because it was one of the first ones I remember was Street Fighter 2.
Sure.
Had all the music and had all the sounds. That was interesting, having this all the you know, the punches and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hurrah, hurrah, you know, all of those. And like, ha, ha, ha. You win. So I would do that because it was so interesting to hear every individual sound effect on its own.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm listening to like 50 different sound effects. This is something interesting. And then like the pause. For some reason, Street Fighter 2 had that. I always thought that was funny. It was like a little beat to it. Yeah, that was the one I remember at the time doing for that. All right. Next.
Pat, Ian, this is Alex from Wisconsin. Hey. Just wondering, have there been any games, classic or modern, that for the life of you just could not figure out why anybody enjoyed? Just you've seen them or played them and said, why wouldn't anybody think this is fun? I don't get it. Thanks.
That's tougher. Like, I historically do not like Mega Man, but I see why others do. I just don't enjoy it. I'm trying to think of a game that I guess has to be popular that you're like, okay, people like this and I don't see the reason why. I won't say something like Fortnite. I see why people like Fortnite. I see that. I see why people like Minecraft. I see it. It's, I mean, for me, I can see it. It doesn't escape me why people like some of this stuff. I understand it.
I'm far more reasonable than I think I may sometimes come across. Paint me out to be on here. I honestly can't think of any game that is generally loved where I don't get it.
I see why people like the Sonic the Hedgehog games. I don't personally like that type of platformer. I see why people like them. It's very tough. You're gonna really have to pin me down if you're like, okay, they're that popular game. You hate everything about it, and it's not made well, and you don't like the genre. Like, I usually don't hate on genres.
Yeah.
Like, I don't hate on, like, well, I don't enjoy fishing games. I see why other people like fishing games. Yeah. And that'd be for me. You know, I can picture someone, no, not getting into a genre like a wrestling game, something very specific. You have to enjoy the product in real life in order to get into it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But I have heard stories where people are like, oh, I never liked wrestling, but then I played an N64 game.
Lots of people that have never had interest in wrestling like those N64 ones.
So, I mean, you're really going to have to really pin me down and be like, well, because there's even some sports where I don't like the sport that much, but I like playing the game. Like, I don't hate bowling, but I never like. I like bowling games, for example. I like golf games. I can't watch golf on TV, but I love golf games.
Yeah.
You know,
I golf video games are among my favorite video games, and I have never watched an entire golf match.
But when I turn it on, I sometimes have gotten into it the past years because I've gotten older, but I'm like, you know, yeah, it's kind of tough. That's a tough one.
Hey, Pat and Ian, this is Brandon from Wisconsin here.
Another Wisconsin.
I just have a quick question for you.
Wow.
So, you know, we've all watched the CU podcast movie. We've all been on the CU podcast cruise. But I want to know, what would a CU podcast amusement park look like?
Oh, it would just be roller coasters.
You're a big roller coaster guy? I'm not a big roller coaster
guy. I'm a huge roller coaster person. I haven't been on a roller coaster in so long, and it upsets me. But I fucking love roller coasters.
Are you playing Roller Coaster Tycoon and all those? Build your own amusement park?
I don't get into those.
I did it once. It was okay.
My problem is I'm just not... those sim games always sound like a lot of fun to me, like the Tycoon games. And then I get in and realize that I have less than zero design sense.
Oh, okay.
I'm bad at it.
See, I like that stuff. I like getting into that sort of thing. I think if we ever did an amusement park, I thought you would be the person. I guess I'd be the one doing the carny shit. I'd plan all the carny shit, all the games of skill in quotes. I would do those.
Skill, yes.
And I'd also make sure we have the food up to go. So,
the food would be good.
All right,
snacks.
All right, Ian. Then I'll do the food and I'll do the carny games then, because I'm all about the carny games growing up at Seaside Heights, where half that shit was illegal. So I know all about how to steal people's money in carny games.
I want corn dogs with cheese sauce.
I know all about doing the little swirly. Remember the swirly like ring game where the thing moves.
Mm-hmm.
Like, impossible to win at those things. I mean,
oh, yeah.
1 out of 100 people. Or like, oh, you got to throw the ball and bounce it off the wall and falls into the tub. It's like, yeah, you can do that because you're at that angle, carny person. Or usually there are teenagers in Seaside Heights, but you can't do that. The only thing that wasn't rigged was like the darts.
Yes. And
the balloons. That was not rigged. Everything else was rigged. The cat thing, throwing those, like, balls, most of those were rigged. So I'll take care of that. But okay, maybe you can make sure I have enough deep fried pickles and Oreos, yes, and stuff and things like that, or ices or whatever else.
Deep fried pickles.
Zeppelis. Mm. Not really. Zeppelis is not really a thing. I guess more of an Italian East Coast thing.
Yeah.
Zeppelis. Okay. A few more here. Okay.
Hi, this is Patrick from Keychain Collectors International. I've never heard y'all talk about the original Nintendo Mini Classics. The LCD keychains.
Oh.
They're Game & Watch re-released, some were original. You ever played them? Do you have any other keychains in your collections? Thanks, guys.
So those came out, what, the early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s?
Yeah.
There was about 4 or 5 of them. Donkey Kong Jr.
Mario got one.
I have a couple of them somewhere.
I had one. So basically they took the old Game & Watch LCDs, put them in little Game Boy style cases,
sure,
which was way more relevant at the time, and sold them. And I had a couple of them. I had one that we did not mention, and I can't remember what it was. And then there was, I definitely had the Super Mario Brothers one, because I think the Super Mario Brothers Game & Watch is one of the... best Game & Watches out there. I think
one of the last ones.
It's a lot of fun.
Was that the last one? Was that after The Legend of Zelda? That was like 88?
It's not a
last...
double screen, but yeah, I don't know.
It's like one of the last hurrahs. Yeah.
But it's a great system. It's a great game. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I don't even know how to search for them, because it's like, how do you even search for them? Okay, I found the Junior. Wow, it's a sealed one. I see the Donkey Kong Junior. I think I have a Donkey Kong one. Did they do a Tetris one? I forget if they did a Tetris one.
I thought there was like a pinball one or something.
Because I don't remember those being sold. I don't know. I guess it would have been, what, Toys R Us?
No, they were sold. I remember, I bought one at KB Toys.
You did?
Yeah. I remember buying one directly from KB Toys.
Oh, then they re-released them as Nintendo Classics. This is a newer one. What's the date on this one? This one's a lot cheaper. Looking for it. Looks like they re-released them after that. 2014, they then re-released them.
Oh, okay.
Because I'm looking at one only $32. I'm like, why is it that cheap? Because it's 2014. It's not. So that's interesting.
That is.
But anyway, no, I don't collect. I got this little cute little chicky with a little flight hat on it. So I don't really collect keychains that much. I bought a couple. Vonnie's gifted me a couple, but I like to display them.
Yeah.
Because I put my keys in my pocket. I don't have a purse or a merce, so like this little cute little guy would be a great keychain. I can't put it in my pocket. It'd be squeezed to death. So, sorry about that. It's adorable. Hey there. All right, a couple more here. This is Joel. Joel.
Hey, Ian and Pat. Joel here, another real Australian. I know you boys love Techno Bowl, but I was wondering if you've ever played Aussie Rules Footy on the NES by Laserbeam Entertainment. It's probably the first game I ever remember talking. It always used to go... out of bounds, on the full. If Dacko is a real Aussie and he played this game, he is pissing himself right now. Sorry if it was a bit long. Thanks.
No, you're a real Aussie, Joel.
I've never played Aussie Rules Footy.
I think I fired up once. I didn't review it for the book. I think Jim did.
I was going to say, it was reviewed for the book, right?
Yeah, we reviewed all PAL games. It's an technically impressive game if you never saw it.
Yeah.
Bigger sprites. It's an impressive game.
I generally don't like Beam. I don't feel like Beam made much that was...
No, Laser Beam Entertainment.
Oh, Laser Beam. Okay. No. So I was going to say Beam was...
Beam Software?
Beam did Gretzky, I think, and it was fucking miserable.
Was it?
Yeah.
No, Laser Beam, I think, was a different company. It's a fun one. But no one had it here, so we don't have Australian Rules Football.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting game. It's a combination of like regular football and rugby.
Rugby? That's what I've gathered.
I try getting into rugby. I just can't get into it. I understand people love it. People can play it here. And do I just can't.
It's fine.
I need that violence. One more. I don't think we're going over here.
Hello, Pat and Ian. My name's Chris, calling from L.A. My twin brother's in San Diego. We're dying to see Ian's store or Luna video games and meet him hopefully one of these days. But my question is for Pat, and that is, what are your thoughts on Back to the Future video game as being a shooter? I know you're pretty there's been a divide whether it's the shooter or not, and I'm curious to see if you can convince me otherwise.
This sounds like
convince me otherwise.
Chris, you became the douchey radio show host having a comedian trying to lead me into a bit. That's what he just tried to do. Well, I hear you don't think that Back to the Future is a shooter, Pat. Why don't you tell me about it? Well, oh my god, I have to do another one, Chris.
No,
this,
you're not.
This famously comes from there's no divide. Famously, infamously comes from Joey Rue, our
yes.
pal, trying to, in his heart of hearts, convince everyone insanely that Back to the Future is in fact a shooter. Somehow,
I don't think he was really truly trying to convince us of that. I think he was just saying it to piss you off.
No, I think when he first did, I think he was honestly trying to make that assessment because it's vertically scrolling and you can't get the bowling ball to shoot objects. I astutely pointed out to him, though, that no shooter in the history of the world does not start you off without a weapon
yeah.
to fire, and you can survive in Back to the Future without a weapon. And
yes.
in shooters, you need a weapon to survive and to get past things. You can't just avoid things your entire existence. So it's not a shooter. That's all I'm going to say. It's an action game. It's not even a sub-genre as a shooter there. It's an interesting... The more I got into Back to the Future, the more I realized this is actually an interesting attempt to make a Back to the Future game. Like, there's something interesting going on here with a bunch of mini-games.
Seriously, I think it's really not that bad of a game if you turn the volume all the way down.
Yes, and if you slow down that, it's actually the power of love. They got
yes.
away with that, which is interesting. I think a couple of people pointed out the past years, but it is the power of love.
Yep.
Sped up like 8 times, whatever, or 3 times. But no, it's not a shooter. We didn't play at the past marathon.
We didn't.
We usually play that.
Gets pulled out, yeah.
This was a strange last marathon. We didn't play some of our heavy hitters this past marathon we usually do. It was shorter, though. It was a truncated marathon.
Yeah, it was.
It was only, what, 15 hours? 16 instead?
Yeah.
But we usually pull that one out and play that. But, yeah. One more, are we good?
We're good.
Thanks so much for your questions here. We're never going to catch up, potentially.
Yeah.
Because now we're getting a lot of them. But make sure they're nice ones. We appreciate it. And that's it for the CU Podcast. It's been a blast. It's been a hoot. It's been a hoot, Nanny.
Hoot and a holly.
And we're having a fun time here.
We're enjoying our life.
We're 9 days away from being eligible for the vaccine, so that's good.
Can't wait.
The local Rite-Aid and Walgreens will probably have them, right?
So excited.
Well, you're the guy more at risk, you know.
I'm not joking. I'm very, very excited to get fucking vaccinated and go back to the zoo.
Well, we can go back to the zoo.
You can, but I'd rather be vaccinated.
Yeah, because even walking on Newport. Have people are wearing masks.
Newport's been the worst. I mean, OB is just such a fucking scummy, grimy.
It's again
shitty, fucking.
But
goddamn, the I hate it.
Half of them are the hippies we can't stand.
The shittiest hippies.
The shitty hippies.
The shittiest type of people out there.
The people that really don't give a shit about you. They're concerned about themselves. Which are the people, the fake hippies in college that I knew were all those fucking assholes.
Racist, greedy, fucking awful,
just
dirty,
selfish.
Shitty,
I don't know if the ones
selfish.
That knew are racist, but like just selfish.
God, they're the fucking worst.
Just selfish. If I'm not concerned about it, you shouldn't be. The most selfish fucking behavior. The most like un empathetic behavior that a hippie is supposed to be like caring about people and everyone. And no, they just care about themselves and having fun and not giving a shit. So, sorry, I had to point that out.
That's all good.
It's almost yelling at people. It's nuts. All right, well, that's it for the CU podcast. Have fun, everyone.
Bye.
Sorry to make it political at the end, talking about masks.
Masks.
All right, we'll see you later.
Bye-bye.